Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the May 2nd, 2017 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. There are emergency exits to my right at the back of the room and to my left at the front of the room. In case of a fire, please don't use the elevator. If you have electronic devices, cell phones, etc., please silence them so they don't interfere with the meeting. First order of business tonight is a public hearing. I read the announcement. The Tompkins County Legislature will be holding a public hearing at 5:30 p.m. in the legislature chambers concerning Tompkins County's current community development block grant project, Tompkins County Home Ownership Program, number 11, and from the CDBG in the amount of $691,500. Is there anyone here who would like to speak on this public hearing? Megan McDonald, please go to a microphone. Megan.
Good evening. I'm Megan McDonald with the County's Department of Planning and Sustainability. This hearing is part of the Homes and Community Renewal administration process for our CDBG grant, which funds our home ownership program. This program has been running since 1993, and in that time we've had over 380 homes purchased through the program for low and moderate income first-time home buyers in the county. This current grant, we have 19 spots for clients in the program. We've had 13 clients purchase homes to date. The program will be wrapping up at the end of this calendar year. And we have over 16 clients currently looking for homes and three that we expect to close soon. So we expect to spend down the remaining funds. And this body has previously approved some program income funds, and there are other sources available that we hope to continue the program in the future. I believe INHS is having multiple meetings tonight, but they work with the county as the program delivery body for the program and have been assisting since they combined with Better Housing for Tompkins County.
Thank you, Megan. Are there others who would like to speak about on the public hearing on this project? Something we've done for a long time. This is number 11. I see that. It's terrific. If there's no one else who wants to speak, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And we will open the regular meeting. Would you stand with me, please, while we pledge allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we have the roll call of members, please.
Ms. Kellis?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
I am here.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk? Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. John?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
13 members present.
We have quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
And we have a proclamation. I'm very pleased to read it here. This is our bicentennial year, and we're having some events at our meetings. Last meeting we had a reading of a historic piece that was done by our county historian. This week we have something very special, which is the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers. And let me read the proclamation, because this group is so important to our community. Whereas in 2007, the 110th U.S. Congress officially designated the Negro spiritual a, quote, national treasure, unquote, recognizing the significant contribution this poignant and powerful genre of music has made to our U.S. history. And whereas the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers, an Ithaca-based 501c3 not-for-profit corporation, was founded as the, quote, Jubilee Singers, unquote, in 2010 by the group's artistic director, Dr. Baruch Whitehead, to celebrate and preserve the first authentically American sacred music, the Negro Spiritual. And whereas, through their beautifully harmonized choral arrangements, the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers seek to educate and inspire, like their namesake, acclaimed and beloved civil rights pioneer and local Tompkins County resident, Dorothy Cotton, who devoted her life's work to sustaining the cause of liberty and racial equality. And whereas the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers are a welcoming group of diverse musicians of all ages and backgrounds promoting strength, resilience, peace, and social justice through compelling song that was born from the steadfast faith of an oppressed people. And whereas staying true to their humble mission of keeping the unique character of the Negro Spiritual alive and purposeful, now in their seventh year of performing, the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers will reach a milestone on May 14, 2017, when they will debut on the national stage of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. And whereas Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers will offer a free preview of their Kennedy Center concert on May 12, 2017 at 7:30 p.m. in Ford Hall, located on the campus of Ithaca College, and whereas to the brave work of civil rights leader Dorothy Cotton and the reflective and talented work of the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers make them Tompkins County treasures, which are timely and appropriate recognitions given that 2017 is the year of Tompkins County's bicentennial and the year of the woman in Tompkins County. Now, therefore, I, Michael Lane, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, hereby call upon all members of our community to join me in acknowledging their work and accomplishments in support of peace and racial harmony, and to hereby proclaim May 12, 2017, as Dorothy Cotton and Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers Day in Tompkins County.
Well, this is truly an honor. We thank you so much for this proclamation. And to celebrate this milestone, we have a couple songs that we ask that you endure. Enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of our artistic director, Dr. Baruch Whitehead, and the 80 dedicated and enthusiastic voices that make up our remarkable ensemble, thank you for this generous opportunity to sing for you tonight. The Negro Spiritual is among the most innovative and compelling art form our nation has ever known. This music and the narratives embedded within span the breadth of the human experience, stimulating our imaginations, stirring our hearts, and nourishing our souls. When we let this beautiful music in, we discover anew a treasure of stories about life. The joy, the sorrow, the perseverance, the triumph, humbling accounts of everyday people choosing to rise above the indignities of oppression. These poignant stories emerge through the talent of creative composers like Moses Hogan, Raymond Wise, Glenn Edward Burley, Stacy Gibbs, Josephine Polonitz, Stan Spotswood, our own Baruch Whitehead, and more. As you experience the spirituals, you come to understand how this music served as a method of survival by those who were forbidden to speak their native languages, play their native musical instruments, or practice their traditional religious beliefs. So, they relied on their strong American oral tradition of song and proverb to give rise to the first authentically American sacred music. The Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers are passionate about the Negro spirituals, the mighty messages they convey, and the opportunity they provide to educate and inspire. And we are indeed honored tonight to be able to share with you a sampling of this most powerful music. Please enjoy, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Yes. Thank you.
How about one more applause? Very seldom do we have music during our meetings, and I can't think of a time when we had anything any more beautiful than what we heard tonight. And we thank the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers, Dr. Whitehead, and everyone who helped put this performance together. It was inspiring, and it is a real reminder of the talent and the intellect and the history and the forward-looking people that we have in our community here in Tompkins County. Thank you very much. I have another brief presentation. Carol Chalk, could you come forward?
I'm not sure.
We have a certificate of appreciation awarded to Carol Chalk in recognition of 10 years of outstanding service to Tompkins County.
Wow.
There is another proclamation out there, I know, and Dan Klein has put it together, our vice chair, and he'll be talking a little bit more about it unless you want to talk about it right now. Dan, would you like to do that?
I can do it under privilege of the floor.
All right, we'll bring it up under privilege of the floor, but that has to do with a musical group as well. I'm not aware of any executive sessions we have to have tonight. Jonathan, Joe? Well, then let's go to privilege of the floor for the public. This is the opportunity that the public has to speak to us on any topic for up to 3 minutes. If you wish to talk to us, please sign one of the blue cards that look like this at the back of the room and pass it forward. And in requesting to speak to our legislature, you're agreeing to our rules, which are that you agree to a 3-minute time limit, you agree not to raise your voice, you agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. You agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, you agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. And you agree that if you cause a disruption and are asked to leave, you will leave the chambers. We do have a clock on the screen to my left, which will count down, at the end of which 3 minutes there will be an audible ring. And we ask that if you have not concluded by that time to please conclude. I have several of these cards tonight. We're going to start with Teresa Ault. And after that, we have Elizabeth Bergman. Please come to the microphone and state your name and your municipality.
Teresa Ault, City of Ithaca. Expanding the jail to the tune of $19 or $20 million is an expensive way to fix the jail overpopulation problem. It also fails to fix the real problem. Providing adequate on-demand mental health services and easily accessed drug rehabilitation in the community could significantly lower crime and eliminate the very need to bring people into the justice system. For those who are still accused of crimes, despite this, less use of bail can reduce the jail population with few ill effects, as the example of practice in New Jersey shows. Yes, providing mental health and drug rehabilitation to inmates sounds like a good idea, but corrections officers are not trained to provide these services. You wouldn't ask them to do electrical wiring, would you? Don't ask them to be psychiatrists and drug counselors. In sum, take care of people with problems before they become offenders.
Thank you. I have Elizabeth Bergman and then Douglas Bentley.
Hi, Elizabeth Bergman, Town of Ithaca. I spoke 2 weeks ago about the 18 to 21 on the smoking issue, and I'm really thankful that you took the 2 weeks to look it over. I understand you're going to vote it in. And I want to thank you because I think it's the start of a conversation about children and smoking and how we can address it because it's a huge issue. I do hope that you guys will take an extra look at the November 16 law to stop the public housing smoking, you know, at home. It's a real issue in the schools. Third-party smoke is on the, you know, and it does affect the children. So I hope that, you know, we'll look at that. I don't know. I know we're looking at this issue as assisting children from starting to smoke. I think they've started way before 18. So my concern is the addiction and withdrawal issue. I have seen people get into a fist fight for a cigarette when they're on withdrawal. So I don't know. I know there's 18-year-olds in high school still. And I don't know how you're going to address fist fights over someone's liability because they're under withdrawal, and they could say, you know, it's not really them doing it because they're under a condition. So, I mean, it's a serious issue. It's huge. So, but I'm glad you're looking at the problem. I hope we can just continue the discussion because it really has to go a lot further with young children smoking. And seriously, it's becoming a condition. I myself, if I'm in a meeting and someone has just smoked, I will have a problem. I will start choking up. I will start having, you know, my eyes will start dripping, and it's very difficult. So this is an issue from, you know, that's going to extend itself, and it's always been there. So it's good that we're talking about it. I have one question to ask, and then with the friendly injection site for drug and addicts and stuff, are 18-year-olds going to be able to go to that? Because they're not children, they're young adults. And we know they can go to war, we know they can take debt, we talked about this last time. So to say they can't buy cigarettes, I just think it's a black market waiting to happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Douglas Bentley, and then Jennifer Hamilton.
There's a switch on it.
No, this one works. Thank you. My name is Doug Bentley. I'm from Portland. I'm here to encourage you to pass the 221 proposal. Let me apologize first for my speech. Back in August, they found a cancer on my tongue. They proceeded to cut out half my tongue and replace it with a flap for my arm. So my arm is still learning how to speak. I began smoking when I was 15. I put a quarter and a dime in the vending machine and pulled the lever, and the cigarettes came out. It was much too easy for me to get to cigarettes. And that's what this whole proposal is about. It's access to cigarettes for children younger than 18, actually. It's not really to keep people from smoking when they're 18 years old. The measure says nothing about it being illegal to smoke or have cigarettes. It's merely a question of access. When I was 15, I didn't know anyone over 21. I would have had a hard time procuring cigarettes. If you're in high school, you know kids who are over 18 who can get you cigarettes. But it's much less likely that you would know anyone who's older than 21. And by the time you're 21, you might think about whether it's a good idea to provide cigarettes to younger children. When you're 18, maybe you haven't figured that out yet. So if you're in the military, I'm sure your commanding officer would oblige and provide you with cigarettes if you were too young to get them on your own. And hopefully your commanding officer would realize that this might diminish your overall ability to perform in PT and whatever. So that's my basic argument. We figured this out in Portland and passed it. And I was surprised because usually Ithaca's a few steps ahead of Portland in doing the right thing. So I hope each of you got the note that I sent a week or two ago, which kind of clearly explains the reason that we want to pass this measure. Currently, the average age for that first cigarette is about 13 years old. And most 13-year-olds don't really know anyone over 21 who's going to go out and help them get cigarettes. So that's the message we're trying to convey. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bentley. Jennifer Hamilton. Then Ted Sheely.
Can you hear me? Yeah? Good evening. My name is Jennifer Hamilton. I'm from Homer. I'm a public health educator, and I'm also a team player with the tobacco-free zone of Tompkins, Cortland, and Chenango counties. Sugar cookie, Kool-Aid, cotton candy, rocket pop, the Papa Smurf, fruity poops, pebbleberry, drippin' waffles, pop clouds, drippin' dots, circus cookie. And for the young ladies in this town, a special flavor of the month for May, the dainty and delicate pink lemonade. These are vape liquid flavors. This kind of sounds like my 10-year-old's list of whatever. It sounds like her kind of thing. And those are just a small group of examples. There's a long list of different flavored liquid products for e-cigarettes. These flavorings, along with the youth resident themes of sex appeal, glamour, celebrity, rebellion, these are contributing to the exploding rise of e-cigarette use among youth. E-cigs are now the most commonly used form of tobacco among youth. They've exceeded traditional combustible cigarettes. And our youth are dual using. 18, 19, and 20-year-olds are dual using, meaning using both e-cigarettes and traditional cigarettes. These e-cigarettes have become the perfect addiction machine for a new generation. We're seeing this happening again. It's a cycle from an industry that's all about greed and reaching our children. In my work, and I've been doing tobacco control for 16 years, I've talked to people who have struggled with the addiction, who regret. There's not one that I've talked to that has regretted ever starting. I've talked to students in schools with tears in their eyes, with their parents, their grandparents who are suffering from a tobacco-related disease and want help. I've also talked to those who are excited to tell me that they've quit. They don't really know me, but they know what I do. And these are strangers. But tonight you have this opportunity so that very few people from here on out will ever come back to say, I regretted ever starting. You have that power. You have that leadership role. Thank you.
Thank you. Ted Sheely, then Chris Owens.
Thank you, Ted Sheely, Town of Groton. Talk about Tobacco 21. Tobacco 21 is just one of the many tools available in our effort to reduce youth smoking and nicotine use in our community. Taking steps that affect access is a well-documented way to address consumption. Increasing excise taxes on cigarettes, New York State has the highest excise tax in the nation, capping alcohol outlets and service hours, and removing sugar-sweetened beverages from vending machines at school are all successful public health tools. Countering food deserts by finding new outlets for fresh fruits and vegetables is a way to improve access to food for a healthy diet. Smoke-free and vape-free indoor and outdoor areas have been consistently endorsed in Tompkins County. While these are typically recognized as protecting others from the risks of proximate exposure to secondhand smoke and vape aerosols, they are also tools that effectively reduce access to nicotine products and thereby their use. When people are not smoking on the commons, youth do not have access to bumming a cigarette from someone. It also changes the perception for youth that if people are freely using tobacco in public, it must be okay and it must be readily available. Does that mean those youth will not find someone off the commons from whom to bum a cigarette? No. Persistent individuals will always find a way to make an extra effort. However, prevention's corollary to make the healthy choices the easiest choices is make the unhealthy choice more difficult to obtain. The more tools we have to support prevention, the more successful we will be in achieving our goal of a safer and healthier community, both now and, more importantly, in the future. According to 2014 data, 61% of upstate adults support raising the tobacco purchase age to 21, 52% of upstate adults who smoke. Research and experience indicates that raising the tobacco purchase age to 21 has and will effectively reduce youth tobacco use rates. It is not the final tool, but it is one more important tool in our efforts to reduce the social and economic burdens of tobacco use and nicotine addiction. It's a way that we can save lives and save money because we cannot afford another generation of nicotine addiction.
Thank you. Chris Owens, then Lily Gershon.
Good evening. My name is Chris Owens, and I'm the director of the Central New York Regional Center for Tobacco Health Systems at St. Joseph's Hospital in Syracuse. My colleague Deb Menzeff spoke at the public hearing 2 weeks ago and has sent you additional information. Now, I'm here to ensure that the evidence on Tobacco 21 and electronic cigarettes was noted by the members of the legislature. Tobacco 21 will reduce youth tobacco use. It is an evidence-based strategy that has been proven to reduce tobacco use among young people. The first municipality to adopt Tobacco 21 was Needham, Massachusetts in 2005. Over the course of 5 years after implementation, the smoking rate dropped by 47%. In 2005, the rate was 13% and dropped to 6%. In addition, surrounding counties saw a reduction in youth tobacco use. This is the ultimate goal, to ensure that less young people are able to attain these deadly and addictive products. I would also like to note that during the same 5-year time period, no tobacco retailers had gone out of business. It is also important to note that electronic cigarettes are a tobacco product, not a cessation device. On May 5, 2016, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it would extend its authority to include electronic cigarettes in the category of a tobacco product, not a cessation delivery device. If a manufacturer does make a therapeutic claim that it can help you quit, then the manufacturer must first prove through a series of clinical trials that their product is safe and effective. Many e-cigarette companies market their product as a tool to help smokers quit. However, the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research has not approved any e-cigarette as a safe or effective method to help smokers quit to date. Many of the nicotine cartridges or so-called juices contain many products, including but not limited to the nicotine that is extracted from tobacco, propylene glycol, flavorings, colorings, and other chemicals. While nicotine does not cause cancer, it is the element that causes the physiological addiction to tobacco and does have an adverse impact on the body. In addition to the nicotine, initial lab tests conducted by the FDA have found detectable levels of toxic cancer-causing chemicals, including formaldehyde, benzene, and acetaldehyde, to name a few. So while these products may claim to aid in cessation, we know that they are continuing the cycle of addiction. It is alarming to see the rates of young people using electronic cigarettes, especially now that we know how dangerous they are. According to the New York State Department of Health, March 2017 stat shot, the use of electronic cigarettes among high school age youth doubled between 2014 and 2016 from 10.5% to 20.6%, making electronic cigarettes the most commonly used form of tobacco product. Thank you for your time, and if you have any additional questions about e-cigarettes, I would be more than willing to provide you the evidence related to these products.
Thank you. Lily Gershon. Then Jesse Goldberg.
Hey, I'm Lily Gershon, Freeville. So I'm here to continue our conversation about the jail study. And I just have a few things I want to say that in response to things that were said last time. So first of all, we've been talking about services in the jail. And one thing that you had said, Anna, earlier was, you know, why should this be an either or? Like, you know, and my response to that, my question maybe, is, isn't it really an either or? Because we're talking about money. We're talking about $18 to $20 million. So we don't have, it is an either or, because either you are going to spend that money on it or you're going to spend it somewhere else. I mean, we're not talking about, like, let's do $20 million for services and inside and $20 million for services outside. So even though I don't think people that I've talked to, and I personally, and DeCarcere Tompkins, is not against services in the jail, especially if those services are not mental health and detox services, which don't belong in there. But we're not saying we're against the services, but we are talking about, can we have services in there without expanding the jail? And how are we to be sure that if we do expand the jail, that there will be no more extra cells built? In fact, we are wondering, and some of us are wondering, can we have information, please, about what is the setup inside the jail? What are the spaces inside the jail? Because I think often I've heard legislators say, you know, that the public or people who are speaking are uninformed. And some of this information we can't seem to find. The website for CGR does not have more information. And can we get information about what the space is in the jail so that we can do research to see what are these services that you're saying people want in the jail, and can we have those services without expanding the jail? Because we think you can. So that's one thing. And I guess that's pretty much all that I wanted to say is we need that information, and we need more information. And I just don't want it to be this thing saying that, oh, somebody's against services in the jail. But which services? I mean, we had, you know, AAA speak. They said they did not need more space, for example. So let's continue this conversation, and thank you.
Thank you. Jesse Goldberg, then Sherry Cortheis.
Hello, Jesse Goldberg, City of Ithaca. I also want to speak about the jail study, and I'll start by echoing everything that Lily just said, that there's this narrative that's kind of emerged after the last jail study committee meeting that folks who come and talk during public comment are giving this commentary about how we don't want to see services in the jail. That's not quite true. What we definitely don't want to see is no new cells, and we don't want to see new construction and new space, but we're certainly not saying or positioning ourselves against the wishes of incarcerated people and saying saying that we don't want them to have services. That's not what we're saying. Right, so I just wanted to clarify that even further, although I think Lily articulated it already very well, right? And then the second point I would want to speak to is this kind of paternalism that emerged towards the end of the last jail study committee meeting that troubled me personally. So this is, I guess, less about public commenters and more about me as a City of Ithaca resident, right? And I'm concerned about this paternalism that says incarcerated people need services, particularly in the jail, that it's actually services in the jail specifically that they need, because somehow these people have reached a low point in their lives that is a kind of teachable moment for them, and that once they're there, that's when these services can really have their impact. And I think that by framing it that way, we foreclose the kind of thinking and analysis which would do what the study itself is looking for strategies to do, namely reduce the jail population since we're going to have fewer beds, right? Because when we shift our thinking from the individual failures, what we perceive as the individual failures that put people in this low place in their lives, to the social and economic conditions that precipitate what we would call crime, we can think of things that have little to do with the jail itself that can reduce the cost of boarding out or the other costs that we associate with the jail. And that brings us back to LEAD programs, the Ithaca Plan, and other kinds of community programs that folks have been talking about in these meetings. And so I wanted to, I guess, finish by framing it this way, that, like, we are saying that folks who are already incarcerated need all of the services that they express that they need, and they know what they need, and we certainly think that that's valid. And at the same time that those people who are currently incarcerated need those services, every effort needs to be made so that there are fewer incarcerated people, period. And the best way to make sure there are fewer incarcerated people is to make sure there are fewer spaces to incarcerate people in, that there are no new cells. So that's what we're saying.
Thank you. Sherry Cortheis and then Tim Marshall.
Sherry Cortheis, City of Ithaca. I'm going to speak tonight. I'm upset about the SWAT team raid a couple weeks ago. And then I heard there were a couple more this morning. So we know what will happen with those folks. They'll end up out of the jail. But at the same time, a couple, 3 weeks ago, we have a white male that punches a judge, and he gets out because he has to take care of his family. So until the justice system is fixed or correct, I don't think we should even be looking at expansions, because it is not just. It is not a justice system. It is an unjust system, and it has been. But I want to read from the corrections officers, because they wrote a report that they wanted the community to see, and I hope everybody has read it. But what they say, and it is one point, is they say, we are not counselors. However, we do spend a great deal of time with these individuals and are able to identify changes. Dialogue between officers, supervisors, and the other agency programs can be quite productive in accomplishing the goal that the county and its residents want. The jail and its officers can be an integral part of reducing the rate of recidivism if a facility was built as a criminal justice complex that screens, assesses, classifies, and houses individuals. This can be achieved by having 24/7 medical staff, full-time mental health personnel, secure rehabilitation program, increased staff training and manpower, all under corrections officers. We can have all of these things in our community. We have the buildings, we have the resources, we have the people, we have the education, we have the heart. And then I was concerned on March 16th when Judge Miller spoke, and he said that, you know, if there was a like a little pilot program we could do where 6 to 8 beds where a judge could send somebody by a mandatory court order who's on heroin and could detox there. But we just built 7 new beds in 2016, and we expanded the facility by 7 beds and put their recreation facility outdoors, which is why we would like to see a map of what they did to that facility, because we don't know. I don't know what we're up against. I know the road patrol's out there, so that space is free. But, you know, what happened to that? And then Judge Miller also agreed that that new 25-bed alcohol facility, he would not be able to send people there because it is not, it's a non-custodial facility. So I just want to second everything the other people have spoken against. We cannot have these facilities inside the jail. There is racism in this system. There's racism in Ithaca. There's racism all over the country. And we have a reality TV guy show running our country, and things aren't normal right now. So I don't think we should just keep plodding along as things are normal. I have to say that. We're all human beings on a finite planet with limited resources. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tim Marshall. Then Phil Sherman.
Good evening. My name is Tim Marshall. I'm a resident of the town of Ithaca, the parent of three children in the Ithaca City School District, a native Ithacan, and a clinical psychologist. My views on the proposed increase in the purchasing age for tobacco are informed by my experience as the director of the Skorton Center for Health Initiatives at Cornell, though my words here should not be construed as an official position of the university. The debate about the purchasing age for tobacco is analogous to the ongoing societal discussion about the minimal legal drinking age. So given the similarities between these laws, I'd like to make a few comments about the drinking age of 21. The philosophical question about the drinking age is this. Is it fair to restrict access to alcohol for individuals between the ages of 18 to 20 when they are afforded other significant rights, such as the ability to choose to get married, vote, or serve in the military? From a scientific perspective, the question is this. What effect has the increased drinking age had on the health and safety of the public, and in particular, youth? In weighing these two perspectives, the question is whether restricting the rights of 18 to 20-year-olds to drink alcohol is worth it to society. The research on the health and safety effects of the 21-year-old drinking age is compelling. Levels of consumption and related harmful behaviors such as drinking and driving are significantly affected by young people's access to alcohol. One of the major changes that has occurred since the drinking age increased uniformly to 21 is that nationwide there has been a dramatic decrease in alcohol consumption among high school students. When the drinking age increased, it decreased 18-year-old 12th graders' access to alcohol and in turn their ability to distribute alcohol to younger peers. According to the University of Michigan's Monitoring the Future study, the percentage of 12th graders who consumed alcohol in the past 30 days decreased from 72% in 1978 to 39% in 2013. I support the proposed increase in the purchasing age for tobacco for the following reasons. It would decrease access to tobacco among our local youth, since high school seniors would no longer be able to purchase it. It would not make it illegal for 18 to 20-year-olds to smoke. It holds the potential for improving health and saving lives by reducing the risk of nicotine addiction. In my opinion, the potential benefits to the health of our children, youth, and community outweigh the loss of freedom to purchase tobacco among 18 to 20-year-olds. As I think about my son and his friends who will enter Ithaca High School in the fall, I believe that the proposed law would be a reasonable and helpful next step in our community's approach to supporting the health of our young people. Thank you.
Thank you. I have two more cards. If there's anyone else who would like to speak, please sign a blue card and send it up. It's not too late. We'll catch you. I have Bill Sherman.
Thank you. My name is Bill Sherman. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. ACS-CAN is the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. We support evidence-based policy and legislative solutions designated to eliminate cancer as a major health problem. We have worked, I should say I'm a resident of Schenectady County as well. We have worked across the state with many, many counties to on Tobacco 21. I want to share with you a personal story. Both my parents started smoking when they were age 16, about 16. My father, unfortunately, died at age of 58 of lung cancer. My mother is a two-time breast cancer survivor. She worked in an oncology practice. As I was driving 3 hours here today, I was talking to her. I was letting her know what I was going to be doing today. And she told me that she might as well have been addicted to heroin because she did everything she could to try to quit. She tried all the FDA-approved medicines. She tried group and individual counseling. She even tried hypnosis and could not quit. She saw the the burden of cancer every day when she worked, and she had cancer two times. 80% of smokers, our research indicates, 80% of smokers tell us that they want to quit. They just need the help. This policy before you this evening will help thousands of people not even pick up the addiction, because we know how hard it is to quit. So why Tobacco 21? As a gentleman said earlier, tobacco is much too easily accessed right now. And I'm thinking of my three daughters. My two youngest are still in their teens. One's 16 and one is 13. They have many friends who are age 18 because they're in high school. They're part of the track team. They have much easier access to tobacco than if we were to raise the age to 21. They're not friends with 21-year-olds right now. 16-year-olds are not. And so that really, by raising that age, will cut off that social component where they're mingling with kids who have access to tobacco, and eliminates that much easier access to tobacco. So the piece before you today, you have the opportunity to help thousands of New Yorkers in this county, and by taking a leadership stand in New York, by passing this bill to ensure that there is much less access to tobacco, including electronic cigarettes. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Shapiro?
Ilan Shapiro, Town of Ithaca. I'd like to speak to the jail issue to start a little bit with a big picture about it. I was at the final session of the New Jim Crow last night, and I'm just moved by how many people in our community are learning about the seriousness of the mass incarceration system and how its time really needs to come to a close. It's a very, very sad part of our history. It's a perpetuation of the part of our history that's gone on through slavery right up to today. And I think we in this county want to see ourselves as leaders in changing this long chain of structural racism that's represented by it, and that was represented today in the presentation. And there are things going on around the country, in spite of the national leadership, that point to rapid abilities to change that. There are counties in North Carolina, there's the state of New Jersey, where and other places reported recently in the New York Times, where just changing the bail system has closed jails or drastically reduced the number of jail cells. There are places around the country right now where the bail system is being sued as unconstitutional, except in high-risk cases. So even that one thing alone has tremendous leverage to make change. Again, if we take a look at the housing crisis that we have, part of the housing crisis about keeping people out of jail is the recidivism issue, about housing discrimination that happens. And there's a lot of effort right now in the city of Ithaca to find housing for people who are reentering. But we need to be supporting those things as a prevention mechanism. So again, looking at the root causes, racism, affordable housing is the place to put our energy, because we can really make a big dent on the number of cells. So, yes, if we're in jail, we need enrichment. We need different forms of rehabilitation. And it's possible to have those things happen by retrofitting or renovating existing spaces, which may even be jail cells. And we're well aware that certain cells are set aside by gender and by other things, so it's not like there's just a grand number that you can pull away from, but the services that are beneficial in those cells cannot be a substitute for the very major changes that can happen in terms of reducing the number of people that come in. And again, we're on that track already. We've got a detox center that's getting funding. We have a DA that understands what, you know, what needs to be changed in the bail system. So we should grab the lead and really make a dent and show that we're part of the leadership around the country in reversing mass incarceration.
Aaron Griffith.
Hi, I'm Erin Griffith, City of Ithaca. I'm also speaking in response to the jail study and possible expansion. At the jail study, the last jail study meeting, I talked a lot about having access to services within the community. As the meeting went on, it was stated a couple of times that the jail is part of the community. While I do believe that the people in the jail and the staff at the jail are part of, very much a part of this community, I believe the jail itself is not a part of this community. It's specifically there to remove people from our community and not keep them within the community. So that was the first thing. Also, I wanted to echo what Alon was saying about actually confronting the problems surrounding incarceration at the forefront. Another thing that was brought up during the meeting, the jail study, was teachable moments, as I think Jesse was talking about. And while that may be a teachable moment, that moment when you're put into jail or arrested, I know from personal experience within my family and friend community that there are a lot of teachable moments that happen constantly. And access to getting help around here is not easy. If it takes going to jail or getting arrested to get services, I think that's something wrong and that needs to be addressed. Basically, no more cells, you know, services everywhere. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any municipal officials. Am I missing any that would like to speak tonight? Okay. I would like, before we go to privilege of the floor for legislators, I would very much like to... yes, Jim.
thank you, Mike. I received a text message from George McGonigal, who has regularly been here, and there's another meeting in the city, and he sends his apologies.
That was nice. He communicated with us. Thank you. What I'd like to do now is, because there are a number of people here who've come quite a distance to speak to us about the T21 legislation, I'd like to move that up on the agenda. So I'm going to turn to Anna Kellis, as chair of HHS, and ask if you would please move Resolution B.
So I would like to move Resolution B, which is the adoption of Local Law Number B of 2017, a local law raising the legal age to 21 for tobacco sale and purchase.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Let's open it up for discussion. Anna?
So, you know, I guess a couple things that I wanted to say. One is just respecting that this is a very democratic process, and there are people who have varying opinions on this issue, and I very much appreciate that. I think everyone at this point is probably very clear where I stand on this. As a professor and a faculty of public health, I'm always going to look to the side of supporting things that promote public health. A couple things that weren't mentioned. One, the population that is particularly at risk is low education and low-income groups are particularly targeted. And I think that we need to recognize that already in the United States, low-income, low-education groups, which is expanding rapidly, are already facing so many pressures and so much difficulty. And adding health disparities on top of that, I think, is an atrocity. The other thing that I experienced recently talking to a youth just yesterday, actually, and I want to clarify this just in case people are not aware, this is not a criminalization legislation. This will not criminalize youth for smoking or purchasing. This is essentially a fine for businesses that are selling. So this, the way that this is implemented and regulated is through the sale. So it is not a criminalization. And the response that I heard was, great, you know, now we're going to throw all, you know, a whole bunch of 18-year-olds into prison for, you know, smoking. And I really just want to clarify that piece. I think it's really important. The other thing that I think is important to note is when we were talking about e-cigarettes, and one of the traceable substances that was found in the e-cigarette fluid is benzene. So anyone who does any environmental work, I think that's pretty profound. Anyone who's studied anything about fracking, the fracking fluid that's extracted, one of the most carcinogenic substances that is in the fluid that is extracted after they've extracted the gas is benzene. And that has caused some of the most harm to our natural environment and animals in our natural environment that we've seen. It is a proprietary blend, so we don't know all of the things in it, but that was one of the things that was identified and talked about in the whole fracking conversation. So formaldehyde and benzene as traceable substances is not a sneeze. It's not something we can, you know, just laugh at and throw out the window. So I appreciated the last thing that I just wanted to say. I appreciate everybody who came out and recognized that it's not necessarily that we're targeting 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, but that we really are also trying to break the relationship between 18-year-olds being able to purchase and the 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, which are the ones who are the most at risk for smoking, knowing that the average age at which people begin to smoke cigarettes is 13. And what the research shows is that shifting from 18 to 21 significantly affects that age group. And that's the age group that we're really targeting here, and that's very important to me. And if I can have any effect there, I will support it. So thank you.
Rich John.
Thank you, Mike. I plan to vote in support of this resolution. And Anna, thank you for all your work on it. I would like to just say a few words about why. This is probably one of the more difficult votes I have had to consider as a legislator. My district includes the Commons, East Hill, College Town, and a good bit of Cornell University, a little bit of Fall Creek. I represent a lot of students, both at Ithaca College and Cornell. And this is taking away some freedom. Mike, I anticipate you're going to speak, and I think you've stated very well the issues of freedom involved in this vote. And we have to recognize that. We, in taking this vote, if it's successful, we also have a real impact on businesses. And I understand that, and I see one of the business owners is here with us tonight, and he spoke eloquently at our last meeting. You know, we want to support the businesses on the commons, and we have to be cognizant of that. This will have an impact to a segment of their clientele. I wanted to thank Mr. Bentley for coming over and for writing the letter that I got at home. It was a very thoughtful note, so thank you, Mr. Bentley. Mr. Krupa, thank you for taking the time and really talking about this issue and educating me on the FDA stance. And Tim Marshall, your long email. We've had a lot of dialogue in the community on this issue. I've struggled with the issue of the vapes. I think cigarettes are pretty clear in my mind, but the jury still seems to be out on vapes, whether they're a gateway to smoking or whether they're an exit. And I think they're both. But it's pretty clear that the studies are showing where somebody is vaping, there's often dual use. And so it is connected to cigarette use, which I think is a bigger problem. But the marketing of the vapes seems pretty clearly at the younger ages. And I think this is where the deciding point for me was, this is about 16 and 17-year-olds, that if you make a difference for them, you get them to an older age where they can make a more informed decision. And so at any rate, that's where I've come out on this. It's I thank everybody else I haven't mentioned that has talked on this issue. So.
Mike Sigler.
Thanks, Mike. I've talked about this a lot. I just I'm going to go and challenge some of the assumptions that were made earlier, though. You know, I keep hearing us talk about the health effects. I'm not stupid. I get it. You know, it's like, yes, my mother died of cancer from smoking. My daughter's grandmother died of smoking. My daughter's other grandmother died of a heart attack from smoking, and grandfather smoking. Get it. I really, when people come in here and say, smoking is terrible, it's kind of like, well, thanks. I get that part. But this isn't about 16 and 17-year-olds and 13-year-olds. This is about 18-year-old adults. And I'm sorry, but they do have rights. They are adults. They are allowed to make decisions, and big decisions. And the fact of the matter is, what you're basically saying to them is, you're 18, you're an adult, but we don't trust you even enough because you're going to give these cigarettes to younger people. So those are the kids we're trying to protect. But that's not who it's about. We keep saying that it's about the 16 and 17-year-olds, but it's not. It's about these 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds. And, you know, this was compared to drinking before. I want to suggest that the rise of the drinking age had a couple of effects that we don't ever characterize. There's been an explosion in drug use in this country. It's not that they stopped drinking. They just switched drugs. They said, hey, okay, alcohol's hard to get. Marijuana's easier to get. Let's start smoking weed. Hey, it's easier to get prescription medications. Let's start taking those. And you know that that happens. You know that kids, you know, go to parties and that there are prescription drugs in a bowl and, hey, let's pick out. What's this one do? I mean, that happens. And you know that there are kids that are leaving school early to deal drugs right at our high schools. And I'm not picking out Ithaca High School because Lansing has the same issue. Heck, in Lansing, we just had a drinking party broken up with like 100 kids at the thing. So you also have seen an enormous rise, and in Europe at the college, you know this, in binge drinking. The kids are in there, they're pre-gaming, they're getting loaded, and then they're going out. So the other thing that was brought up was the drinking and driving. Well, yeah, I mean, if you unify the age, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, and I knew a lot of kids that would scoot over the border because the age was still 18 in New York State. And then they would drive back, and they would die. And we had kids from my high school. I mean, I remember a girl dying. She was 4 years ahead of me in high school, and that's how she died. So, yeah, it was a uniform age that did the most, that helped that along the most. So, again, I mean, I can bring up everything you're allowed to do again. I mean, should we raise the age of driving? Kids are texting more than adults, assume it, right? I would assume that. Maybe not. Are they responsible enough to drive a car? I don't know. Maybe we should raise that to 21. How about sex? Should we raise that to 21? Because kids are having sex without condoms, they're getting pregnant, or they're getting some kind of disease like herpes, and that doesn't go away. So maybe we should, you know, raise the age on that. Or maybe we should raise the age of student loans. You're 18, you're really going to take out a $100,000 student loan to study journalism? Because that isn't going to pay you back. So, so, I mean, you're making these giant decisions that are going to impact you for the rest of your life at 18. And I'm sorry, I just can't go into this assuming that these 18-year-olds are just, well, we're just going to be giving cigarettes to 16-year-olds. I know it's going to happen, you know, but I can't go into a situation like that where I'm making an entire class of adults not quite adults. So, thanks.
Will Burbank.
Well, Mike made most of my arguments. So.
I'll leave some meat on the bone this time for you.
Thank you. And it's nice to be able to agree with Mike on at least this issue. But like Rich, this one has troubled me. I consider the tobacco companies merchants of death. They are one of the few products, maybe the only product, that if used precisely as designed, it will lead to illness, if not death, for a huge portion of the users. We have gotten numerous emails and messages, and I really appreciate the effort of Mr. Bentley, who came over to speak with us and sent us this wonderful letter talking about his personal experience. The negative effects of tobacco use through smoking are indisputable. Yet, as Mike has pointed out, there are other things in our lives that are also cause harm. And in our state, at age 18, you are legally an adult. And I just have a hard time getting beyond that, even though I know that if we do this, if we make it harder for these young adults to get to buy cigarettes, that will have the positive effect on people that are close in age to them. It's interesting to me that in this whole discussion, one group that I have not heard, or we've heard very little from, are the people that will be affected by this. I think there was one young man who came and courageously talked about how it was going to eliminate his job. But I have not been getting calls from that. And, you know, that's a case where their rights are in play and they have chosen to remain silent. I understand that this will probably pass. I will be voting against it. But this is one case where I will not be truly unhappy to lose, because I think the positive effects will be there. Anything that we can do to continue this discussion, specifically relative to secondhand smoke and the effect on others, I think will be a positive thing. Thank you.
Peter Stein.
I've been back and forth on this issue since the very beginning, and I am really troubled by this issue. I have a strong feeling for not making decisions for adults. And as far as I'm concerned, a 21-year-old is an adult in this country. And if a 24-year-old feels that it's important enough to smoke, even though it hurts him, I think he's got a right to make that decision. I had a right to make that decision, and I decided in the wrong direction. I'd rather smoke because I liked it so much, because I was addicted to it, and it took me a long time to get rid of it. And I'm glad that I did. But the things that bother me about, well, first there is that, the notion of the liberty of adults to make their own decisions. That's not a trivial thing. And that makes me want to vote against it. I mean, what I really would like to do, frankly, if I had the opportunity to vote to make it a criminal to manufacture and sell tobacco in the United States, I'd put up both hands. Because I think that should be done. But the people that make money out of making tobacco makes that impossible, okay? So that's not an option. The other thing that bothers me about it, I mean, I don't really know how much it's going to reduce the smoking. My own gut feeling, having been a smoker at that age, is it's not going to be as much as people say, because I've discovered, no matter how old you are, if you got a credit card and you want to go on the web and buy cigarettes, you can do it. And that's going to kind of have, this law will have no effect on that whatsoever. And it's my guess that what we hear about the positive results of this are overstated, because I can't imagine how they took the data to figure out that once they did that, people didn't go out and find ways to get cigarettes, like simply ordering them on the web, things that are perfectly legal. So I wish I could believe all these numbers when people come in to testify to us and say that the smoking has dropped in these people by factors of 3, factors of 4, something like that. I've not seen that data, and I question whether it's true because of this huge loophole that exists everywhere. So when I put it all together, I think it's not going to do any good. I think it's conceivable to me that it'll even do harm, that people will feel the need not to be torn by you, not to be made by you, not to do something that they want to do. And that they'll. And I think it's so easy to be able to get cigarettes afterwards that I find it hard to believe that this is going to work. So for all those reasons, I'm going to vote no.
Carol Trock.
So, look, nobody here thinks it's a good idea for 18 to 20-year-olds to smoke. We've heard the research that it is harder to get off later if you're exposed earlier. We've also heard that that's not even the ages we're looking at for the real problem. It's younger than that. Kids like to do things that they're not allowed to do. It's part of the point. the differences among us come regarding how to address it, where scarce public dollars can be most effective with monitoring and of sales versus education, whether a perception of government overreach will impact public health and safety in other arenas. This body used to compromise more. We used to do more to try to achieve compromises. And I think it's a symptom of the times that we weren't able to come together and do that a little bit more here, because I think that while the research is clear on the tobacco, the nicotine, and some of these other substances like benzene that Anna mentioned, and some other substances that get added by the tobacco industry, the large tobacco industry, as opposed to the smaller organic dealers who sell pure product, in particular, there's no debate about those. I think that for me, my district also includes the majority, the main part of the Cornell campus and Upper College Town. And we need the students, the 18 to 21 year olds, to respect it. When we ask them not to drink and drive home, we need them to respect us when we ask them to be good neighbors and to follow other laws. And for me, the parts of this that aren't based on scientific research are the parts that bother me, and that I think will bother the educated youth, as well as a perception of some government overreach as opposed to an attempt to reach them through education. So the compromise that I would, nevertheless, I think that tobacco, nicotine, and the items that the industry puts in are harmful enough that I would vote for this if there weren't some other things that I think represent overreach. And for me, that compromise would come with eliminating the words, it's at the top of packet page 9, or any combination thereof. We can make a case that all of the research is there related to tobacco. We cannot make the case. We haven't heard any case made here that we should turn over the decision to well-meaning staff people who do a good job and have many demands on their time to keep current with what research there is on what substances that are added in combination with tobacco. But to say in our law that if there's a combination that doesn't even include nicotine, or a substance for which there hasn't been any research, that we're banning that too, the sale, that makes no sense to me, especially as the state goes back and forth and continues to raise the age for things. So I'd just like to move one more time to take out those words, or any combination thereof.
I have a motion for an amendment from Carol Chalk. Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Discussion on the amendment. Anna?
I understand, Carol, the conversation about compromise. I disagree that we don't do a tremendous amount of compromise on this floor constantly, which is, I think, indicative of the 5-hour-long meetings that we tend to have. I have looked at this over and over again, and one, I will say a few things. I will repeat, shisha almost exclusively contains tobacco, and the versions that do not contain tobacco cannot be distinguished unless
every single sample was sent to a lab, which I think any sane person would recognize that that is not feasible, to take a chunk of every single pot of shisha that went into every single store and sent a piece of it to the lab before that they could sell it. I can't wrap my brain around that. But there's that part about this conversation about shisha. But if I'm just looking at the technical aspects, well, that's one piece. The technical aspects of this sentence, shisha means any product made primarily of tobacco or leaf or herb. And what you want to take out is or any combination thereof. And what I understand your interest is to say if it does not contain tobacco, then it should not be included in this list. That is my understanding here. But removing or any combination thereof does not actually succeed in doing that, because technically the sentence would read tobacco or other leaf or herb, which would state that it could be something made of leaf or herb. So I just wanted to point that out. The third thing that I want to point out is that in my conversations...
The word primarily is in there.
Which is what makes it okay to have it with any combination thereof, in my opinion.
Let Anna finish.
The third thing that I think is very important is that this statement, the way that it is written, is identical to what is written in the state law as we have it currently on record for 18 and under. And in my conversations with Mr. Krupa for the Department of Health, and I respect this, that if we make a law that is one requires one regulation and intervention for those under 18 and a separate law intervention for those for 19 and 20, that will be exceptionally difficult, not just for the Department of Health to implement, but I think extremely confusing for everybody in the community. So either we do something that's the same that we already have and shift the age, or we discuss not having it, because I do not want to have our Department of Health having the complication of trying to implement different laws for different ages and different groups, and I think that that would get very confusing. So
on the amendment, Martha?
Basically, I was going to ask Frank to or Ted to talk about the enforcement issues if we do make this change, and I if you have anything to add, I would invite you to the microphone. But I think to say we don't compromise is a wild generalization that doesn't. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's some things that you know you're either this or you're that. There's no compromise in you know. I don't think that's a fair generalization. But Frank or Ted, if there's anything to add about what this change would mean in terms of the practicalities of enforcing the law.
Frank Krupa, our health commissioner.
I think Anna covered it well, and I've shared with you all the department's concerns about both enforcement, education, and really the vendors. It will put added burden on them, both from an education perspective for their staff, as well as maintaining compliance. The more different the rules are for different groups, the more complicated it is for them to make sure they remain in compliance with it. So we very strongly support keeping the language the same as what's in the state law, so that simply all we're doing is changing the age.
So I would just say I'm against this this amendment, but I'm for the law.
Carol, did you want to speak again?
Well, if there are other people who want to speak on the amendment first.
I didn't see other hands on the amendment. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, so, Frank, I had a question for you as well. How frequently are you going to be able, under this law, to send people in and monitor compliance?
ultimately, once it's fully implemented, we would go to all of the facilities that are licensed, and we would also need to be able to identify those other type of facilities that could now be under this regulation that are selling products. So the expectation is that eventually we will get to all of them on an annualized basis.
So once a year you'd be able to go monitor at a cost of?
I think the number right now, so it's difficult because there is this idea of having to do two checks, right, if the age changes. We spend roughly between $18,000 to $20,000 in staff time associated with doing the checks. So I'd imagine it would roughly be about half that much additional to be able to do them. So it's a relatively low-cost program because there is a relatively low number of facilities for us to do it. But there is the complication of having to have age-appropriate individuals participate. So there is some cost associated with that.
So, but is it your sense that even though we can only go on the order of magnitude of once a year to check, that having the law is going to do any good?
Yes, absolutely. I think we've stated unequivocally that we believe the law will have a positive impact on smoking rates in children here in our county. And we have worked under a system where doing annual checks has thankfully produced relatively low noncompliance. We have seen a few upticks in the last couple of years, so obviously we need to continue our efforts. But yes, unequivocally, we believe that this will improve the impact on tobacco in our community.
Okay. Well, thank you. If it's not feasible, it hasn't changed my mind. I appreciate all the work that folks have done on this, those who are trying to have us do it, but it just seems to me that the money is better spent on education. And if it's not feasible, you mentioned feasibility of sending samples off. If we're really only able to check once a year, it seems to me we could find the money to send samples from those checks off to a lab. So I think I would keep my amendment on the floor. And, you know, if there were people who think that the wording problems you pointed out were an issue standing in their way, I'd work a little more on it. So once I hear from people, I won't bother to take up people's time.
Anyone else on the amendment? Ready to vote on Carol's proposed amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. All those opposed? That fails. Now we're back to debate on the full local law. Dooley Kiefer.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to still look at page 9 of the law. But I'm going to ask you to look at Section 3, which at the moment reads minimum sales age restriction. I spoke with our county attorney about the redundancy in that section title. Mm-hmm. And so I would suggest we get rid of minimum and just call it sales age restriction. So I think that's a non-substantial change.
Is that a manifest change?
Can you, we didn't get exactly where that is, Julie.
Just the title of Section 3.
The same page, packet page 9.
You want to take out the word minimum, is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Is that friendly?
Yes.
Is it friendly to the seconder?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like to speak to the subject in general.
You have the floor.
It's fine to hear all the talk about freedoms for people, but the freedom of a person to pollute the air I have to breathe is something I don't agree with. And nobody's talked about being near, living with, sharing space in a room with, sitting next to someone whose hair and clothes reek of tobacco smoke. Secondhand smoke is not good stuff. And so that's another reason that I support this. It will reduce the amount of tobacco usage to a certain degree. That's an additional reason. in addition to protecting younger people. So, Peter, I wish that would move you.
Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Mike. I came in here fully thinking that I would vote no on this, and it's been very interesting discussion listening to my colleagues and some of the people here. And I'm going to bore you with my personal history on smoking. I smoked from the time I was roughly 20 years old until I was about 48 years old, and bought a bunch of those patches, and after 6 months it went away. And basically my mind changed because, one, the people around me who I cared about were so annoyed with me that they said they didn't want to ride in the car, they didn't want to do this, and it, you know, they were more important to me than smoking. I can't remember what it was anymore, but some light brand. And so I stopped that. But 15 years later, I ended up with the same thing that man ended up with. I had squamous cell carcinoma, right base of tongue, went to Sloan Kettering, spent 4 months in radiation and chemo, came away with the ability to talk. And some people would say that's a good idea, others would say that's not a good idea. But at any rate, I was able to do that. Didn't eat for a year because I had a food tube. So that was all the things that in my graduation from Sloan Kettering, I remember. And it was because of smoking. And what troubles me about us trying to tell 18-year-olds they can't smoke, these people can kill or be killed in Iraq. These people can get giant student loans and have to pay that back. They can overeat processed food, become obese, end up with hypertension and diabetes, which is pretty prevalent. And I don't know at some point if we would pass a law to say there can't be processed food. I don't know. The kinds of things that that are interesting to me about the whole idea of saying to 18-year-olds, I also don't have any saliva, so I actually spent a little time going around the county talking to convenience store owners, and convenience store owners pretty much agree that 18-year-olds don't buy cigarettes because it's too expensive. $9 is about as cheap as you can get unless you go someplace else. What they do buy a lot of are blunts. And the blunts are used not to smoke cigars like a Wall Street banker. It's to wrap weed in. And that's what they're using it for. So they're really, the cigarette business has kind of gone to hell for under 21-year-olds. But the other part of it has gone up considerably because young people, being as smart as they are and have learned so much about the cigarettes, have switched to another method. I spent 30 years in the Ithaca City School District. Every year we would have somebody from BOCES come in and talk about the evils of smoking cigarettes. Every year, year after year. We had people from the health department come and do that when the health department had a lot more money and they were able to send people in to that. But we also had people come in and talk about the anti-drug thing to all the elementary schools in Ithaca, particularly, and all around the country. And I don't know what that did, but I don't know that the drug use went away because 4, 5, and 6th graders and through junior high school had decided, oh, we're not going to do drugs anymore because of this program. So there are a couple of things, other things that I find really interesting. You can get $1,500 on the college boards. You can come to Cornell University and you can't smoke. Now, I'm guessing if I'm smart enough to get 1,500 on the college boards and I get in Cornell, I'm not going to smoke because somebody along the way has said, Jim, that's a bad idea. And, you know, I'm going to buy that. But the kinds of things that are going on, 16, 17-year-olds, these people, they're able to get through a lot of windows, and I don't mean real windows, but get the things they want to get. And it's so easy to have some 20-year-old, 21-year-old say, you know, here, buy me this, buy me that. And they continue to do that. So I think that the whole idea that we're going to slow something down, maybe a little, but I don't think it's going to change the brain of a 17-year-old kid who actually wants to be cool and hang out with his friends and smoke some cigarettes. And they'll do it for a while, and then somebody will wake up and say, God, I can't afford $10, and, you know, I'm going to do something different. Maybe I'll drink. Maybe I just quit all this stuff together. But and the final thing for me is it would be a real easy vote. Almost both ways for me, and yet I haven't, you know, I said at the beginning of my little speech here that I came in here fully intending to vote no, and I may have convinced myself to vote yes at this point, and hope that young people actually will listen to adults, will actually think about this. Schools will continue to say what they say and do what they do about these kinds of things. But I don't have a five by eight of any of this changing very much, especially in this county. I do think at some point New York State will kind of lay this over all 62 counties in New York State, and it will come into fashion in other places. But it's been an interesting time listening, and I've spent a lot of time here hearing discussions about many, many topics, jails, and this one has been one of the best, and I appreciate the fact that all the people that came here and spoke to it, the T21 positively, everyone can use the facts that they can find. I mean, I can find facts that smoking has decreased in the United States, and I think it has because, you know, there are more and more things going on. It's so expensive, and you know. So I'll probably vote yes, but I have real doubts about the yes vote, frankly.
Let's go to lesson
I'm not
being
sure
clear
that I'm going to change the world with it, or we are either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do I follow that, man? And Mike Sigler. And yes, Mike, I would like an S30 local law, you know, sex 30. I have an 11-year-old. It's not good for her before 30. That's what I say. At any rate, this one has been a struggle for me, too. And I said this to Anna and everyone else who's worked on this, that there are portions of the language in here that trouble me. But I was convinced that, you know, it's a state law. It's what we've been operating under with T18, and we're just going to have to go with it. Now, I have the privilege of working with young people and interacting with young people on a daily basis. And I recall something that a young man in, it might have been Washington, D.C., it was there last year, talked about, just in what sort of made them change their minds in getting involved in illegal activities or things that were not good for their own health. And he said, it's not the laws that you pass. It's, as Jim said, it's the person who says to me, who knows me, might be my grandfather, it might have been the mentor down the street who said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. And that's what sort of wakes that thing up or woke the thing up in me that made me stop doing certain behaviors. we can pass all the laws that we want to pass on this body, government always, and usually, you know, stricter to government, wiser to population. They figure out ways to do the things they want to do. I do have my concerns as the lady who spoke earlier, the community member, about what's her educational plan that will help stop people from getting into the black market with this. We knew that when the price, or at least I know, that when the price for cigarettes went up, there were so many people selling cigarettes on the black market at cheaper prices that it became an issue. Not so much up here, it was up here, but very much in downstate. And then people started getting jailed for that. And here we are talking about not throwing people in jail and not building bigger jails. So we have to make sure that we are taking a real holistic approach to this. What is going to stop our young people from, you know, fighting because, you know, they want to get that cigarette or they're withdrawing or whatever it is? Okay. Don't know. I will vote for this because I think every little bit helps. You know, I did say this to Anna yesterday. I still have some issues with it, but it's the state law, and I will support it. But I also want us to make sure that we consider those other social factors in our educational campaign, and I'm looking at Frank, and to all our community members as well, that we take time to make sure that we are helping our young people to ride this wave in a way that's not going to get them or others criminalized and having to face some sort of justice system or unjust system punishment. So I just want to make sure I put that out there.
Thank you. Martha Robertson.
Thanks, Mike. After Jim and Leslin spoke, I thought maybe we should just call the question right now and stop talking, but of course I won't. So
I did too, Martha. I thought, arguments already?
Well, according to Peter, I can't. I've already blown it. So so quickly, a couple things. One is, I mean, Mr. Bentley, thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody who came from Syracuse, Homer, as well as Cortland, Schenectady County. That means a lot that you would schlep all the way here. Coming in person really does make a difference. My father, cigarettes made so he couldn't walk. He had atherosclerosis and heart disease, dropped dead at 72 with cigarettes in his wheelchair pocket. You know, he couldn't help it. My father-in-law dropped dead at 65. So same thing. Really important to say this does not criminalize the kids. It's not illegal to smoke at 12. It's not illegal to smoke at 18 or 20 or 20 under this. It's illegal to sell to them under this law. That's really, really important. I want to say for businesses, you know, government does stuff all the time that makes people have to rejigger their business model. You know, the Internet comes alive. So what happens to Buffalo Street Books? They have to figure out some other way to make a living. You know, we change zoning laws, so a business has to figure out, okay, what do I do now based on new zoning? Or we put, you know, you have to put calories on your restaurant menu, or you take the calorie listings off. Or there are things we do all the time that affect how businesses need to operate for various public policy reasons that we consider carefully. And we say, okay, this impinges on somebody's freedom over here, but there's a reason for it. There's a good enough reason to give that up to get this. And as far as consistency, well, if you're 18, you can do this. Look, every one of us, no matter what age you are, we can get a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt, for riding a motorcycle without a helmet. You know, there are any number of things that we do, for public policy things that we do, that impinge on our freedom, but there's a reason for it. So, again, this does not cut down on children's opportunity to smoke. That's what they want to do, and if their parents want to give them cigarettes. But it just makes it a little, maybe a lot harder to get it. And I think research has shown, especially in the initiation, in the first days of the temptation of starting or not, those barriers can make a difference. Those barriers can keep somebody from starting. And I wish my father hadn't started when he was 16. There are a lot of years that he missed and that we missed.
I want to speak that before folks have a second shot here. I really want to say thank you to our health department. Ted Sheely, you're standing in the back there, and your efforts here are phenomenal. Frank Krupa, and you and all of your staff who brought this forward. It wasn't easy to talk about, I know. And Dr. Klepak, who came and spoke at our meeting last time about the American Medical Association's opinions and other things like that. I really think it's important that this was brought forward. And Jim, you mentioned that the state is apparently taking another look at this law, and perhaps it will happen. But I really believe that the reason the state is taking another look at it is because New York City, particularly, and at least, I believe, 6 or 7 counties now upstate have passed the T21 legislation. And they're showing that the grassroots is in favor of these kinds of laws. And the other thing I wanted to mention is about maturity. Yes, age 18 is a legal requirement that changed, but maturity is a different thing. Maybe we shouldn't draft people when they're 18. I don't think many of us would object if we changed that. People, when they're young, still have, and 18, still have maturing to do. There's a reason that 21 was at common law was the age of majority. It was when they thought people could begin to handle their own real property back then, which was wealth, and also other things that people could do, contract and other things. And that's why it persisted for so many years. In my own legal practice, I often write wills for couples, so they ask me to do that for them, and often they have young children. And we generally, when we do that, they're concerned about, well, what happens to our children if something happened to both of us in a joint accident or something? So we set up guardianships and trusts in the will to protect those children in case something does happen to both of them. And I always ask the parents, what age do you think is appropriate that the trust would end once these children got older? No one ever says age 18. They always want to go 21, many at 22, and a lot at 25, because they know young children, their maturity level cannot be assumed at age 18 because they're still growing and maturing. So I will support this law tonight. It's because I believe that 18 to 21-year-olds still have a little maturing to do, and this will help them make decisions. People who want to speak another time here, I have Anna, Carol, and then Mike.
I'll just say one thing. I have spoken to a whole bunch of youth, so I don't want people to think that no one has actually gotten their point of view. I'm not going to call into question maturity. I think that, you know, I teach 18 to 21-year-olds, and holy whoa. I did a med talk with a group of students. And there was a freshman who stood up who I was sure was going to change the world sometime in the next 5 days with that brilliance. Was a freshman. And everyone in the room was 18 to 20. And there was over 100 students. And I gave both sides of the argument for and against T21, trying to be as neutral as possible because I'm a scientist. I really kind of wanted to get a sense of it. And I do believe that the science, this is a case where it can rule out. And about 80% of the people in the room voted for T21. So that, to me, was an indication. I can tell you I did another room where it was 18 young men. It was all men, by chance, at a conference. And that wasn't the same. I did the same test, and I had about 40% of the people in the room. So I know it's a mixed bag in youth. I think that it's important to be honest.
Thank you.
And I respect their decision, but in my experience, the majority, which is over 50% of them, were not opposed to this T21. So that made an effect on me. And if people wouldn't mind, I'd love to call the question.
Mm-mm. Can't do that now. You talk.
Oh, because I talked?
Mm-mm.
Oh, is that how it works? Oh. Well, I took that chance away. I'm a newbie at this.
I have Carol, Mike, then Leslin, and then maybe we can get to a vote. Carol?
You all are going to do this. I have a question for Jonathan. A couple of people have referred to the state law, and I think somebody who came in here showed us, and then a couple of comments we've gotten, showed us the laws that were passed in Albany County and Cattaraugus, which are also based on state law, refer to two other substances or names of products, name categories of products that, like shisha, and I don't know how to pronounce them, but one of them is gutka, and one is B-I-D-I-S, bidis. And that, I believe that's in the state law. So shouldn't we be including that here if we're trying to base this on state law?
Maybe Frank would be a better one to answer. I know that in all the cases I've done, I've never had any which involve those two things that you just mentioned. So I'm not sure it's that relevant.
Is there anyone can speak to that or not? Frank Krupa.
The short answer is no. I don't have that information in front of me. We have been through this through multiple iterations, and as far as the department is concerned, what we've proffered is what we think is the most appropriate way to address this issue, and we'd like to stand on that at this point.
Mike Sigler.
I don't mean to come across too cynical here, but I appreciate that you talk to 18 to 20-year-olds about this, but they clearly aren't of present mind to kind of talk on it because they can't clearly make a decision whether to smoke or not.
That's up debate.
Need to rein them in. So again, don't mean to be too cynical about it, but Mike Lane actually touched on an interesting issue, though. You know, before World War II, the aging majority was 21. I mean, pretty much throughout the country, and it changed. You know, because we needed soldiers. And I'm just wondering if government operations, maybe we could ask them now to kind of look at the other things we should be changing in the county. Maybe we should change the age of majority to 21. I mean, maybe we should make, you know, the ability to sign a contract is a big deal. Maybe we should make that 21 in this county. You know, if you want to get a lease to an apartment, we should do that. Make that 21. If you want to get a student loan without a co-signer, 21. Maybe the age of marriage should be 21. I mean, that's what it used to be, and that's kind of what we're shifting towards here with smoking. And again, smoking is the low-hanging fruit. Nobody likes it, right? 80% of the country doesn't like it, so it's easy. But when it comes to some of these other things, you know, I wouldn't be against that. I wouldn't be against saying to people, you know what, age 21 to join the military, because you can't make that kind of decision until you're the age of majority. So maybe that is something government operations would like to take a look at. So thanks.
Lesson McBean.
Thank you very much, Mike. And that is why I wanted to echo something Anna said. And that is and that's just your opinion, Mike, that I don't like the presumption that 18 to 21-year-olds aren't matured enough to make decisions, or 20-year-olds. I just want to voice that.
Peter Stein.
I'd like to move the question.
I'm ready to go to a vote. And do we need to call it?
No.
All right. Let's just proceed to vote.
Okay. Call for a roll call.
On the local law, we'll have a roll call, please.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Klein?
No.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
No.
Mr. Stein?
No.
Mr. Burbank?
No.
Ms. Chalk?
No.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Anyone wish to change her or his vote? Please announce the vote.
9 ayes, 5 noes.
The local law is adopted. It's time for a break. We'll take 10 minutes and come back. We're back in session. We're going to approve to the floor for legislators. Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Mike. With the Jubilee Singers here and the wonderful job they did, we've been searching for some way to use this place, and I think that's the best use that I've ever seen. The acoustics were pretty good, and we should have singers every week. They were amazing. So that's my thing.
Anna.
My brain is all over the place tonight. I finished burying my cat about 10 minutes before I got here today, and it sounds really silly.
You're
losing.
Sorry.
Thank you. She was almost 20 years old, as I've had her for a very long time. I know for some people it sounds really silly, but I think when just those moments when you have an experience where something you loved dearly dies, and you get that pause, and the rain's falling. I'm like in the mud, in my knees, my covered in mud tonight, and like tears, you know, the whole nine. And there was something, I don't know, just a moment of quiet where I didn't have my cell phone and I didn't have my computer and I didn't have, like, you know, 50 million phone calls. And for a moment, I just remembered to appreciate the world stopping and just loving something. And I just hope as a race, we start appreciating those moments a little bit more and take time to do those things. And just realizing how few evenings since the election that I have unplugged and had dinner with my family or hung out with my cat. So sadly. So I guess I'm wishing that for all of us, that maybe we can slow down a little bit and have that quality. But besides that, I wanted to thank everyone from the Decarcerate Group and from all of the different nonprofits in the community for coming out. I've been like chanting that for a while, and you guys are coming, and you're continuing to come. And I think that that's awesome. One of the things that I did want to respond to is the conversation of whether things should happen in the jail or outside of the jail. A lot of the discussion at the last jail study committee was about the programs that were happening in the jail. But for the 4 or 5 months prior to that, the conversations were what was happening in the community. And next month, it'll be about this coming one on May 11th will be again about something happening in the jail, which is the medical facility. And then after that, it'll be about harm reduction, which is the alternate to the war on drugs, which is something I'm very much in favor of, and not the war on drugs. But an amazing woman who's coming to speak. And so, again, it's more what the experience for us in this position as a legislator is that if you go every month, then you start to see a story that, for me, being new in the legislature, I've found very refreshing because I came from the, you know, activist group. And I guess the one thing that I would like to say compared to, so we go to conferences where there are legislators from all over the state. And so their experiences are all over the state. We have the full range of experiences. And Tompkins County has a very unique experience in upstate New York. And I guess the one thing that I would like to plant a seed is the possibility that maybe we're actually aiming for the same thing. And what would it look like if we all collaborated and had a vision? Because my experience, and I don't know, you know, there's tons of variance among people in Tompkins County government of what we should do. And I've seen tons of variance in the community. So I'm not saying that, you know, everything's fine and good and we're all in la-la land. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I think in this topic, it doesn't necessarily need to be polarized. And I think that there's a lot of discussion within the study group and motivation and goals for prioritizing reducing the jail population as much as possible. So having that creative conversation about doing that, I think, is amazing. I also wanted to say that I very much appreciate the request for transparency. I, too, feel very strongly about that. I've spoken with people in the jail about doing a documentary so that people could, you know, I don't think it's the right thing to do to parade the public through the jail and treat people like less than human by being stared at by everybody in the community. I don't want to condone that. I want to treat everybody with respect. But I also think that everybody should see it and get a sense of it. And, you know, that was certain. I got a positive response, and that's something I'll work on. So I am in support of that, and I will work for that for sure. As far as data, as far as I'm on the same page with that. So I guess in summary, I just want to say keep coming. There were some numbers that were thrown around. I think numbers like 12 million to 18 million or 18 million to 20 million. And that can only be used for one thing inside and outside, the jail. I haven't heard those numbers. I would love to know where they came from. Because I haven't heard them as a government person or in committee. So sometimes I think we have information in subgroups that may not necessarily be what is really on the table, and sometimes it's things are siloed. So the more we talk, I think the better. Anyway.
Rich John.
I was going to speak to the same thing, and you said a lot of what I was going to say, so that's fine. I'm sorry about your cat, by the way. That's hard.
It's just the red eyes. I excuse. They look like a mess. That's all.
I wanted to make sure, one, that I said thank you to everybody who came in to talk about the jail study, and to make sure that you all know that the meeting for May has been changed from the 18th to the 11th, so it'll be next week at 5 o'clock. May 11th, it's Thursday. I know I've said it before, but I do want to just reiterate it, that the purpose of the study is to find things out. That some speakers have come to us saying, you guys have already made your decision, and you want to build a lot of new beds, and that's news to me. There's five members of the committee, and none of them have said that to me. Well, the other four haven't said it to me, and I haven't said it. And what we have preached to each other is that it's really important to keep open minds on this and to wait and to be really patient and to hear and listen as much as we can. And that's what we're trying to do. But at any rate, thanks for coming. Please come next Thursday or a week from Thursday, and we'll see you then.
Dan Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk about the Grateful Dead for a moment.
So earlier we had a really nice musical event, and you know what I think it actually does share with the Grateful Dead is it's about the power of community and music, and specifically this community and music involves the Grateful Dead's concert in Cornell in Barton Hall, 1977 on May 8th. It has become the most famous Grateful Dead concert of all time. And the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of that is this coming Monday. So therefore, it is going to be Grateful Dead Day in Tompkins County on that day. There's a bunch of events happening. One is the Cornell Chimes, the bell tower at Cornell, is going to be playing Grateful Dead music at 6 o'clock on Sunday, on Monday. And that's when I'm going to be reading the proclamation right before that little concert. And then later that night, there's two different Grateful Dead cover bands that are in town that are going to be playing. So there's going to be a lot of excitement around this event. And if you know, to help you take this seriously, I wanted to show you there's this book that Cornell University Press just put out, an entire book about the one concert. Cornell University Press, they publish serious stuff. And if that doesn't help, I can tell you that the Cornell 77 Grateful Dead concert has been deposited in the Library of Congress. So somebody's taking it seriously. I also happen to know that there are two county legislators in this room right now who are at that concert.
Uh-huh.
I am not one of them, unfortunately.
Dan, if I can interrupt, I think I snuck in.
Who was the other one?
How old were you?
Statue
of limitations.
Under
18. I was. The last thing I just want to say is that the Grateful Dead has provided inspiration for me and for a lot of other people in this county and beyond, and that's that is actually why I'm wrote that proclamation. It's brought a lot of good things and a lot of good people into my life, and so that's why I just wanted to take a moment to commemorate that. Thank you.
Martha Robertson.
Thank you. All good stuff. And congratulations, Anna, and thank you for all the work on the T21. It's important that we're doing hard stuff here. On the jail, just a couple of other things that agree that, we certainly haven't talked about any new cells. We haven't made any kind of decision. And I think the $18 to $20 million number probably comes from the estimate from Labella 15, 12 years ago when they did a design, we were under a similar gun from the Commission on Corrections, and so we went through a whole design process, and they proposed a similar 45-bed pod or something. I think that would have been $20 million then. Clearly would be more than $20 million now, and that did not include staffing, the additional staffing that would be required to manage such a space. And on their way out the door, literally, they said, well, and by the way, this estimate doesn't include staffing, and we think the long-term cost will be higher for staffing than for construction. So I was very pleased to be one of eight who voted against that, and we did not move ahead with that expansion by an 8-7 vote. And so that's probably where the $20 million comes. I would encourage people to – it's funny, the stuff that's in different places, our public safety committee is where we have the jail statistics, and every month those are posted, and you can go back, you can see back many years – you see the graphs, and it seems that there was a peak in 2015 and then things dropped and bounced a little, but then there's really been a strong drop since June of last year. And I think it does show that there's a lot that this community can do, but we have a lot more tools to try. I stopped by the Safe Space Injection Site pop-up exhibit on the Commons this afternoon. And there's a panel discussion about it at Ithaca College tonight. So I know that the Ithaca plan is touted, and there are lots and lots of things in the Ithaca plan, and most of them are things that Tompkins County would be responsible for, not the city of Ithaca. So I
I hope people are thinking about all of the things in the Ithaca plan and not just a safe injection site. For my money, if, maybe that's the wrong phrase, in my opinion, injection, I understand harm reduction. I believe in it. I was on the AIDS work board when, you know, 20 something years ago when we put out the first, when we developed the first safe needle program, you know, needle exchange program. So I believe in harm reduction. I, however, have not seen anything to change my mind that that safe injection site should be nothing but a last resort. Let us try all the other things first. And there's a lot that we can do, and we've got great nonprofits that are making making headway, and our departments are making headway and working with Ithaca Police, et cetera. So I encourage people to keep coming to the meetings. I also understand that, that CGR has reached out to decarcerate for a meeting. At the last jail study meeting, they indicated that they hadn't heard about decarcerate. In the meantime, they have reached out to the group. My understanding is that there hasn't been a response. I would encourage folks to respond and to go and to meet with the CGR. They that's what I understand. If that's incorrect, y'all can reach out to them anyway. So that's what I would say.
Just respond.
You want a response?
Yeah. Just an update clarification. I was the one who reached out to decarcerate last night. And that was after speaking, Rich and I spoke about knowing that they, so I'm going to broker that, and that's on me. I'm about to put that out.
Let's go to Leslin, being Claiborne.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I want to say a great big thank you to everyone who came out this past weekend for Streets Alive, Cinco de Mayo, and A Taste of Muslim Culture. It was quite fascinating and interesting to see sort of that fusion of cultures in, you know, just a little square block, and knowing that we all can keep doing this kind of thing, as you were speaking to Anna, just taking a moment to enjoy what's around us without judgment and without preconceived ideas, etc. So it was an absolutely wonderful event. Happening in that little square block there at GX. I want to thank everyone for that, for coming out. Following Grateful Dead will be the Ithaca Festival coming up soon. So the 2nd through the 4th of June. So please mark your calendars. We've already said that we'll be a part of that festival. The county's bicentennial float will be there. As part of it. I want to respond also to the folks who came up and spoke about the whole jail study. I am when I hear things like we shouldn't have, unless we're going to get rid entirely of the jail, which I don't imagine is happening anytime soon. There's movement towards it. I get that. I hope that conversations around making sure that there are programs in the jail for people who are in there does not get seen as described as patronizing. I'm sure when we decarcerate the jail, you know, there'll be another, I don't know. How many people are in the jail? 66? Okay. 61 of them will be my family members, and I'll be happy to have them home. Y'all know me. I am honest to the bone. I don't say to people what, you know, they want to hear. I say what's my conviction and my truth. And I don't want them, if they committed a crime and the law as it stands right now says this is the punishment, you go to jail. I don't want them to be in Cortland County. I don't want them to be in jail, no. But if that is what happens, I want them to be close by where I can go see them until we do something differently. I don't know how many people here have worked in a jail, but I walked the halls of that jail right here in Tompkins County. sitting in interview rooms, talking with inmates, interviewing folks, providing just on-site counseling. And I remember when our jail had enough program space, it's one of the reasons why I voted against the dorms, the addition of the dorms, because I remember when we had enough program space to allow for classrooms, to allow for our library, to allow for residents there at the jail to engage in AA and NA and religious therapy if needed. And more those spaces were being reduced. I don't know what's left anymore. And having walked those halls and talked to those inmates, some of them won't speak to anyone else. And here, if we're going to be here, here are some things that we need. I don't want to take that away.
Thank you.
At all. Because there is nothing worse than being in jail and not having something to stimulate your mind and help you to continue to grow. Then it really is just, let's lock them up, throw away the key, punish them, all of that. And that's not where my head is, and that's not what it's about. I know the jail and prison situation all too well. I have a son serving 10 years in South Carolina prison. I wish he was here, that I can see him. So I don't want anybody to stand up and say we shouldn't have services in the jail. We should. If we're going to have a jail, we should have services. These are human beings. And yes, I'm very passionate about it. I'd rather they don't go to jail. But I also do want to see, as Martha put it, more services in our community. This county is heads and tails above most, if not all, other counties in New York State with our alternatives to incarceration programs. And I've been involved with those for years, every time we added something new. And I know there's more that we can do and we should be doing. So we should be looking at this all around, not just from one perspective. I hate putting my business out there. Nobody come asking me about my son now. I'm just going to tell you all straight up. But that's just the reality. That's where I spent a big part of my life and my work. So I know what it feels like in there. I know what it feels like when we have women locked up and there's no place for them to really get some services because they are the minority and so they are just in this one little section and no place else to go. So please, all I ask is for all of us to step back and look at this from a real comprehensive perspective. Services outside enhance and increase, so we send fewer people to jail. And in the event that we have to send people to jail, that they get services inside, that they can come out as better citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. I have Carol, Will, Peter, then me.
Boy. You're going to make me follow that, Leslie, and I appreciate the sharing that you just did. thank you, and thanks to people who came and spoke to us about all the issues that they did. I wasn't going to about just to say a word. I think that there, you know, I agree especially with the end of what you said, that, you know, we ought to find a way to distinguish and deal with the numbers
that we need to have in there so that we can have the services we need to have for the people who need to be there. I did hear from people a request for information who came and spoke to us about the jail issue, a request for information about sort of the layout. And I believe that that was public information that we, in those earlier conversations that we had about when we did the recent changes to the seven beds and the yard, that there were the other rooms there, and so it ought to be in some agenda. And I don't know if we can put it on the CGR site, but maybe point people to the right meeting where that would be part of the. They could go back to the agenda packet and see it. Okay, so to go from that to the Grateful Dead, I was going to say a word. Thank you, Dan. The only thing I will add is that it was really, in addition to the fact that that was one of the Dead's finest concerts ever, it has stood the test of time with many, many Dead concerts that were taped and distributed. One of the reasons that that was distributed and has, you know, remained sort of the oldest big concert that that the most popular is that the Cornell engineering students, of which I had been one, but only for a year, years before that, came with some of the best sound equipment that had been used to date to record a Grateful Dead concert. And so there was it's still pretty scratchy, but you can hear it. Maybe it's just the copy I have. It was recirculated so many times on tape. But I do have it if anybody wants to hear it. My personal experience with we had tickets to that concert, so let me reminisce for a minute. But I was in Seabrook, New Hampshire, singing folk songs with Pete Seeger in the afternoon about renewable energy and the unproven technology of the proposed nuclear power plant right on the shore. Rhode Island doesn't have... New Hampshire doesn't have that big a shoreline there in that section, and they it was proposed to take up most of it with this nuclear power plant. And so I was there in the afternoon, and we left a little bit early to rush back. And on the whole way back, we wrote a speech that was one of the best speeches I've ever written, under the illusion that we are going to get up in front of these thousands of people at intermission and give the speech and convince people that they needed to work hard for renewable energy. And if we did it together in the 1970s, we would be there within a few decades. That point, I think, was that when it was Jimmy Carter president and he had solar panels on the White House? At the time, taken down later. What I was going to talk to you about tonight, this ties into, because I attended last night, meeting of the Dominion company about their project to expand the, to put new equipment in at the Borger Station. Now, some people pronounce this Borger and some Borger, and maybe our Dryden reps can resolve the...
Well, the employees call it Borger.
Borger, but the community calls it Borger.
Well, I would think the people who work there might have...
No? Okay. Well, okay. In any case, and this is the pipeline I've been talking to you about since 2014 with 50, 60-year-old welds that were going to triple the volume of gas moving through. And this company says that if you have the closed-loop system and then you increase the volume inside of it, that it doesn't do anything to the pressure. Maybe our physicist can explain that later. It was quite a disappointing meeting, to say the least. This was a new low in all of my years since the 1970s. Of going to energy-related meetings, of disregard for the community. They brought a huge team of people. I don't know, were there 10 staff people there maybe? But of these 10 people combined, 2.5 hours of essentially questions from the community. I think they said they couldn't answer almost all of the questions. There really wasn't one that they really fully answered. They turned down just about every request. After this 2 hours of relentless requests from the community, they agreed to look again at the list of questions and ask their superiors whether there were any of them that they could answer. But the guy who's in charge of the project, who is the main person doing the negotiating with FERC, was there at the meeting, so I'm not sure who they're going to ask. The level of ridiculousness, there's not much we can do anymore about this project. The level of ridiculousness of you know, how little they would try to work with the community, is illustrated by the, you know, after hours of people asking about the science and the pressure in the pipe and what was the percentage increase that we might see to the what's going to go on there. People were asking about the conditions on the construction site. And the woman next door who said that she does work with people on the West Coast, so she has to stay up fairly late to do her work. But when they've done projects in the past, at 7 o'clock in the morning, the construction hours are going to be, they want them to be from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, the construction hours while they're working on this. She asked if when all the people came in with their trucks and arriving at 7 in the morning because she needed to work late, could they pull in frontwards rather than backing up because their trucks would go beep, 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 you know, the safety feature in the backup. And they said, no, it's company policy to back in. There's really not much we can do anymore but learn for the future. Basically, they have their permits. So I'm not sure why their timing of coming to us now. There are many requests since 2014 to come and talk to us about this project. We put in formal requests. We put in informal requests to come and answer questions. They have all their permits. It's been determined that we can't challenge any of those permits. And now they're coming to answer questions. So the lesson for the future is maybe we just make sure to get all our questions answered and asked and answered well in advance of such projects.
Thanks. Will Burbank.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Leslin, for those very important words about awareness of what's happening in our jail. Thank you, Mike, for inviting the wonderful Jubilee singers into our midst. I had no idea that this room had such wonderful acoustics. And I hope we have other occasions to put them to good use other than us talking. You may have noticed it's spring. It's May. Yesterday was May Day. When I was young in elementary school, the way you celebrated May Day was we had a thing called a May Pole. We danced around this pole when pulling streamers, and it was lots of fun. It was much later that I learned that May Day has a very interesting history in terms of our history. It was in 1886 that there was a very important demonstration in Chicago in support of the 8-hour workday, and it turned unfortunately violent. It was the Haymarket massacre, basically. Workers were killed, police were killed. It was a sad, very tragic event, but it is being commemorated around the world to this day as a time to to think about the importance of labor in our midst. Interestingly enough, this country seems to be least aware of it. You can go to countries all over the world and they will have May Day celebrations, but here it's relatively rare. As it happened yesterday, we had a little May Day encampment on the west side of town, on the very west end of Martin Luther Luther King Boulevard, down near Pete's, where a group of anarchists had set up a Food Not Bombs information tent and were trying to make people aware of the day. I happened to be driving past, and I got out of my car, and at great danger to my own life, crossed that section of the street and chatted with them for a few moments. And I was very happy to see young people out there sort of keeping this this bit of history alive. It also got me thinking, though, about that particular area of our city, because there's been a very active discussion on the West Hill listserv about a proposal within the city to basically change the traffic lanes crossing the bridge into the city and reducing it from 4 to 3, and doing so to enable construction of a much safer bicycle pedestrian pathway. And it's been a very, very contentious issue on West Hill. A lot of folks just being very angry that cars would be burdened. But other people arguing passionately that we really need to do things a whole lot more for those who get about on foot or by bicycle. Which brings me to my final thing. I Leslie mentioned Streets Alive. It happened twice a year, and last Sunday was the spring version. It was a wonderful event, and I took my rusty old bike and starting at GIAC and working right down all the way to the high school. Saw people dancing and singing and sharing food and just meeting people. And it really made me aware of what can happen when people get out of their cars and just connect as a community. Mm-hmm. So I hope more of that will continue. Thank you, Mike.
Peter Stein.
Take me a while to remember what I was going to say. I was deeply moved by what Leslin had to say. You know, we Americans have very different life stories to tell. I have no experience with people in jail. I've never known anyone in jail. To me, jail was a mystery thing that I didn't know anything about. And when she was talking, I was thinking, how would I have felt if one of my children were put in jail? And I Leslin, tears came to my eyes because I know what that means without ever having seen it before, or I know what you're feeling, okay?
Thank you.
And I feel for you. My whole experience with the jail, I was never in a jail until I became head of public safety. And so I went to see what it was like, what a jail looked like. And I was appalled when mm-hmm. they took me nicely and walked me door to door. You know, when we went into the men's portion of the jail, I was sort of comfortable, but I could see what it's like to be there. But when they took me to the woman's portion of the jail, I was just embarrassed. I felt like a sleeping Tom. What's the word? Yeah. Peeping Tom. I was embarrassed. I wanted to get out of there. I mean, the whole experience was just absolutely devastating to me, and it certainly had nothing to do with anyone I knew. So, and it really changed my mind about the whole situation, and I have a much better feeling about it. But the reason that I really didn't decide to talk just because I wanted to say that, but that's sort of my introduction. But today I was listening very carefully to what the people said when they got up and talked about the jail study group. I concentrated on it and tried to, you know, I can't always hear so well what they say, but I tried very hard to understand what they were saying. And unless I got it all wrong, the message I had from those people was that they believed that the number of people in the jail was, to speak in my own language, a function of the number of jails we had, jail beds we had. And of course, that's got absolutely no connection to truth. I mean, people who say that don't understand the system. And I'm sorry to you shake your head, but I believe that if you believe that, you must believe that the people who put people in jail, who are judges someplace or other, when they make a decision as to what is going to happen to the person who has been found guilty by a jury, that what they do is somehow in their mind, they say, well, how much room is there? And if it's pretty tight, they say, well, no, I guess we're going to have to not sentence this person to jail. Now, I just do not believe that that's the case. I've tried to look into that. I've tried to talk to some judges in just general terms. And I've come to the conclusion that judges are like us. They're decent people who are trying to do what they're supposed to do. We're a nation of laws, and we're a nation of giving certain people a certain right to make certain distinctions. And that ends up with certain people who have done certain things and who have, a jury has decided that they did it, and then the judge has the responsibility to make a decision on what the punishment will be. And as near as I can tell, I've never heard anyone say anything with any kind of data that makes me believe that system does not work. I don't understand why there are more black people in the jail, but I mean, I've still discovered that at all. I don't understand it, and I find it disappointing, but there it is. But nonetheless, I think we are a nation of laws, and that the number of people that are going to be sent to jail at any particular time for the acts that they've done and the decisions that the jury have made has got nothing to do with how many places there are in a jail. I just really don't understand why we have not been able to educate these people who I think speak from their heart to understand that that's not the problem. The number of jails we have is not the problem. I'm convinced that that's true, and I wish we could get that across.
Julie Kiefer.
Thank you. We had marches over climate change, and people seem to think that what's important is to say there is no planet B. The planet's going to survive. It's humanity that's not going to survive. And we have overpopulated the Earth. We use too much resources. There are too many of us. The first Earth Day, which is 40-some years ago or more, the population bomb was a fairly new concept, and the first Earth Day was about controlling population. I'd like to talk more about this at some other point, but I think the meeting is long enough tonight. I don't like to have anything but a disastrous view of the future, but that's what I have. And I would love to have a cat that I could forget everything with, but that's not the way it works for me. So I envy you that.
Well, I don't have that now.
No.
Thanks.
I wanted to take a minute to speak about a constituent of mine. As we know, this year is the year of the woman. And the constituent that I want to talk about lives in the village of Dryden. She moved into the village of Dryden with her family in 1921 when she was 4 years old. Onto a farm, not a very prosperous farm. Seven children, a couple. Didn't eat all that great. Worked out from the age of 12, helping to clean people's houses. Went to Dryden High School and played women's basketball. Loved it. Graduated high school, went to work. Dedicated to work her whole life. Worked in factories. Worked canning beans in Cortland. Worked at Morris Chain during World War II. Went to Buffalo to find a better job with her husband, and she was one of the first two women hired at the Curtis Wright factory, where she was a tool chaser and was not very well received by the men who were working in the factory, who would do things like spit in front of her when she was walking down the aisle. She raised children. She worked at Smith Corona Marchant and retired from that. She worked very hard to try to have a union formed in that factory. That didn't come to pass. She lost her job for union activities and was rehired back because it was a technique that that many industries used to try to fight unions. Every 2 weeks, she sits in front of the TV and watches our meeting. And I have to be very proud of her. Her name is Viola Lane, and she's my mother. And last Saturday, she celebrated her 100th birthday. Thank you, and pardon
happy
me
birthday.
For that. Person.
Should we break out in happy birthday to her?
She's watching. Is she watching?
That's all right. We have three people that would like a second chance to speak tonight. Is there any objection?
Yes.
Let's keep it real short.
Very short.
I'm afraid that this privilege of the floor for legislators, you haven't been good at policing yourselves for 3 minutes.
I will be very short.
Anna Kellis.
I only bring this up because it's something that happened today. It's very important. There was an ICE arrest in Tompkins County this afternoon. I just got word of it. During the legislative meeting, after I spoke, I wanted to communicate with everyone that this happened. The only reason that we know about it is because a Cornell student observed it and communicated it. There's something that people don't understand, and I want to just speak to absolutely everybody in this room, that we all need to educate people about what's going on. The resolution, the Public Safety for All resolution that was passed in Tompkins County, and the sanctuary ordinance that was passed in the city does not prevent ICE from moving anywhere they want in any land that is U.S. territory. All our resolution says is that we will not cooperate in such a way that would use our resources, our personnel. We won't collect any data. We won't do their job for them, but that does not prevent them from coming here. So people need to understand that, and there have been a couple cases of citizens actually calling ICE, and I have now discovered this. One Cornell student I've heard about a DACA student at Cornell who is now in hiding. I want to reiterate that the sheer act of being undocumented in the United States is not in and of itself a crime. So if we can make sure that we educate people in our county that that is the case, then maybe we can help some of the people
who are undocumented, who are here. So I beseech everyone, implore them that it's, you know, the sanctuary title is not a protection in and of itself in that regard. So we need the education.
Martha Robertson.
Thanks. I'll try to be quick. And Aaron, if you could communicate to Alon. I guess Alon is left. Peter, there is such a thing as induced incarceration. And let me explain what I've seen and heard. And it, I believe it's real. It is the idea that everywhere along, there are many decision points in the system that result in somebody being in the jail, whether it's, you know, what happens at the scene of an alleged crime, whether, you know, is there desk bail, is there an assigned counsel, is there a good attorney with the person, what happens, you know, what does the DA want to do, all the way down the line. Does OAR exist so they can get there? And it is, I believe, a true statement that when the criminal justice community understands, as I think they have since June, that we're in a vice with the Commission on Corrections about to pull our variances, then people start to look for every single possible way that they can to maintain public safety with other ways that rather than putting somebody in jail. The opposite works in other communities where this is true. Studies have shown that Joe, you're in Onondaga County when they had an overcrowded jail, and I can't remember the number, something like 500, it's a big county, 500 people in the jail, and they thought they needed more, so they built, you know, another 300-bed jail. I'm making up the numbers here, but they're big numbers. And, like, in a year, that was full, too. And they needed to build another. It happens over and over again. And it is, I think it's not that people say, well, I'm fine, jail's full, let's throw them in. It's that the pressure is off. It is that people are... It is you're designing your system to say this is where people belong, as opposed to saying, let's find ways to have them be somewhere else. And when the community is saying to us, if you build it, they'll fill it, I don't think there is. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. So I don't think it's something that's made up, and I think that it's the reason that we have a different experience, because our community is dedicated to the opposite as opposed to other communities that just say, well, we guess we got to build a jail. I guess we got to build 250 more beds like our neighboring county. So I just think that there's a lot of information out there that really corroborates that.
Rich John, then let's move on.
Martha really covered it. I won't speak further on the subject.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to chair's report and chair's appointments. I'll pass on a report tonight, and I don't have any chair's appointments. Let's go to our county administrator, Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Mike. I just have a few updates. I've been reporting regularly on a few things, and I'll just post you on where we are with those. One, we've been talking about a new option for retiree health. We've talked about that the last several meetings. That's finally going to make its way through the legislative process. It'll be on the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee agenda on Monday. There's information about it in your packet, so if you want to look at how this shakes out, a comparison of the Platinum Plan, which is the option that is being proposed for offering. If you want to compare that to the current plan, there's a side-by-side in the packet, so you may want to take a look at that. I think it's an important development, and again, the kickoff is in Budget Committee on Monday. The other thing that's going to begin moving through the process, and I talked about this last time as well, is the Tompkins Trust Building, the proposal to acquire and improve it and make it ready for the History Center and several other agencies. That will also begin to find its way into committees, beginning with F&I next week. So that will go next Tuesday. And again, there is information that will be in the F&I packet when it's released, maybe tomorrow when that comes out. So you may want to start taking a look at that information as well. That's another significant initiative that is going to be coming your way. The law enforcement shared services study, not much to report on that. There was a conference call today, still deep into the research phase. The consultant CGR have a mountain of data. This is the police study, not the jail study, that they've been working through and are organizing that. There's a couple of data pieces that they're still waiting for, response times to incidents, specific units that responded, some fine-tuning that they need still. I believe when it's all over, we're going to have some really good information that we can that will be very helpful as the options that they develop and present to you are presented. So they're still kind of into the quiet phase of data analysis on that. This seems to have a law enforcement feel to it, but centralized arraignment, we've been talking about that too for some time. And you recall that that's something that came out of the TCOG study of the courts. It was a recommendation of that task force. It's something that the state has now made available as an option for counties. I've talked to you about some prior meetings that were held. There was a meeting only of the magistrates last week. About half of them attended, but it sounds like there's a consensus in that group that let's leave well enough alone, that the system of after-hours arraignments with counsel present seems to be working okay. So there seems to be a sentiment toward it's not broken, so we don't need to fix it. I think all of you know that this is an option that's favored by law enforcement. They lose a lot of time while they wait for a judge to be found and then seated. Law enforcement supportive, the DA supportive, the assigned counsel supportive. But again, at this point, the magistrates don't seem to be there. So not sure about next steps yet. I guess the only thing I can say is at this point, only half attended. Maybe the other half is supportive. I don't know. But I'll keep you posted on that. And again, we'll scratch our heads about appropriate next steps. Just two more things. The budget itself, so the spending targets and the property tax goal, again, is going to begin coming onto the legislative calendar, beginning with budget committee next week, and then coming to you at your next meeting to set the levy goal and spending targets. So that will soon come your way. And lastly, and I'll be quick here because we've talked so much about it, that shared service initiative, the state shared service initiative, in spite of all the concerns that we have about it, and frankly my personal belief, it's going to be almost impossible to come up with a good plan on the timeline that's been established by law. There is a law. And there is a need to follow the steps that are outlined in that law. You have a resolution that will be before you tonight that kind of recognizes what this process is going to be over the next few months and the fact that it delegates to me a lot of things in terms of organizing a plan. But I need to assemble a panel. The panel has to include mayors and supervisors. It may include school superintendents, and I think at this point it will. I've got to do that quickly. I've got to get ideas from them and from that group, develop a plan. I then need to move the plan over to you. And in that transition process, there need to be three public hearings that we're going to have. We need to invite labor input into the process. And by the middle of September, you will have needed to report out a plan. You don't. I don't think you can veto it, but you're going to have to comment on it at least, maybe modify it. It has to then be approved by the panel, and then it has to go to the state. If it doesn't get approved by the panel, I have to write another report. That report says why it didn't pass and who didn't vote for it. So that's the progression of things that have to happen in short order. I mean, time will fly. So if the resolution that's on your desk tonight passes, I will send the letters out tomorrow to mayors and supervisors to get this process kicked off. So, and I guess my last comment is, I think the Jubilee Singers ought to be here every meeting. What a wonderful tone that set. I swear it elevated. This has been a great night for discourse. Lesen, that's one of the most powerful speeches I've ever heard, and none of us are ever going to forget that. So my vote would be, although I don't have a vote, let's bring them back every 2 weeks, because I think they set a great tone. That's my report.
Questions? Glenn.
Who's going to move the Resolution C?
I think Dan might.
Can
we do it now?
We're going to add it to the agenda.
Okay, at the end?
Yes, we have to add.
After reports, yep. Let's go to Carol next.
Wait, so did we ever learn what the penalty is for not following the governor's plan?
Yeah, there's no monetary penalty. There is no sanction. There is still a law that we're obligated to follow the process, but there, we've looked and looked and talked to everybody. There is no monetary sanction.
Okay, and when are you anticipating this panel coming back? What's the? Tell me in the time frame that you're envisioning for
by
this?
By August. I think it's by August 1st. There's so many dates. I think it's by August 1st. They need to have a plan that comes over to you.
What happened to the notion of, are there still counties looking into or thinking about making it a longer process?
Ours is one. We will, I mean, that's an option that we'll have to consider once that process begins, whether we say there's just not enough time and let's concede that we can't get it done this year and start working on August next year. So that will be an option that I'm sure is going to be discussed.
Wait, should I just keep going or wait till this is on the floor to ask some other questions?
This is a question for him, but yeah. We're going to bring that resolution forward if this group votes to add it to the agenda.
Okay, well, should it be added to the agenda? Do you think it should be with something added to it, Dan, that says, you know, we want to make that ours, we're going to make sure there's enough time to do what needs to be done? That you know, we're not holding them. It specifically says we're not necessarily holding them to
why don't we wait until we talk about that resolution? Martha, questions for the county administrator?
Yes. So disappointing, but I suppose not surprising about the magistrates. Sunlight can be powerful, you know. I don't want to say disinfectant, but they're elected, yet the public knows pretty much nothing about the job they do, except if they happen to be or have a family member in front of the courts. So it is, I believe, am I right that the, you know, when officers are looking for a judge, they have to go through, you know, calling this one and not getting that one and blah, blah. Do they keep records on who actually shows up when they have an arraignment? Is that information?
I think that record is kept. I don't think it's an official record. I think it's kept informally, but it might be kept.
Well, it must be kept that there were 10 arraignments in the town of Dryden in the month of May, and they were all heard by, you know, Jules Ravo instead of Chris Clausen.
Right.
So if we could collect...
Hypothetically, right?
What?
You're saying that hypothetically.
Yeah, just hypothetically.
Right.
If we could get that information, if that could be tabulated and made public, I think people need to know who actually is showing up at 2 in the morning and who's not. And, you know, it's like we're in public here. They're paid by the public. They're elected by the public. Let's find out who's actually doing the work. So how do we do that?
Yeah, let me see what we can do.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, was there anyone else had a question? Dooley.
Yeah, at our budget retreat, and I apologize for arriving late, but as I understand it, there was not really much information on livable wage, what it would cost. If we wanted to make sure that agencies we contract with could pay their people appropriately, And this is the year when every other year Alternatives Federal Credit Union updates its living wage calculation, and it usually is available around June. So it's information we couldn't have had in time for the budget retreat. But I don't know whether you have an estimate of what it might cost, your best guess based on inflation.
I don't, and it's not that I haven't tried, but I don't. When this happened 2 years ago, I took a shot at an estimate, and it was wildly wrong.
How wildly? I don't remember that.
Well, I don't know that I really broadcast it widely, but a couple of years ago, I think there were only a couple of agencies that came to the county and said they needed more of our money. And so far, there's only, Food Nets is right there on the margin, so they seem to be affected by it. Mm-hmm. So I wish I knew, Dooley. And I think the unknown, there's one major unknown, and that is how many can absorb this in their routine fundraising and their own revenues, and how many can't absorb it and will have to come to us to maintain their living wage. I don't know.
And we can't know until we hear the new calculation. So
and, yeah, whatever, until they ask.
Whatever budget brings us, we'll be missing that piece of information through no fault of budgets. But it's an important piece of information for me, and I hope we could make an allowance for that.
Real quick, Mark.
Yeah, I think in the state budget they included a bump for direct care workers. No or yes?
And then they took it away.
They took it away?
Yeah, the direct care workers. So that's
a nice idea.
Food Net is coming back to us for some help. Because they were receiving some of that money. There were assurances given that that money would be ongoing, and it's not. That program apparently wasn't very well used, and so the state took it away.
Just for Food Net or for other?
I think it's all direct workers. Yeah. I'll confirm it with Lisa. She's the one that's been watching it closely, but it's my belief that it was taken off the table.
Like the Racker Centers and all those people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, home care workers, yeah.
19,000 for Meals on Wheels, by the way. That will be coming to the ledge.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
I do not have a report.
I would like to mention that Jonathan part of a panel this afternoon for the Tompkins County Bar Association continuing legal education, which I happen to attend, regarding the Constitutional Convention, and particularly John talked about the role of local governments and the mandates and other things that are affected in the New York State Constitution. Did I get that right, John?
That's right, but Hank DeLay did most of the talking, and he's a no, it's a good thing because he knows a lot more about it than I do.
Well, we appreciate your being there. Our finance director is in school. He's off at NYSAC for a couple of days getting new information about government accounting, I guess. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, that doggone
right.
Gatsby.
Gatsby. Are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Dan Klein.
I'd like to add a resolution authorizing the county administrator to establish a shared services panel and to undertake the tasks assigned to county chief executive officers by state's shared services legislation.
Is there a second? Seconded by Glenn Morey. Any discussion? It takes 10 votes to add it to the agenda. All in favor, please raise your hand. Are there any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Dan. Don't think we have any appointments on the consent agenda. And there's no resolutions on the consent agenda, so we don't have to deal with it. Let's go to committee reports. Transportation Committee did meet briefly, and we spent the time talking about our meeting previous in the month with the State Department of Transportation. We were a little short of members, and so we'll be meeting again this month, later in the month. I forgot the date. Any questions? Let's go to Government Operations Committee. Dan Klein is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to meet tomorrow, May 3rd at 3:30, and the meeting is going to be in the old jail conference room instead of here, so a different location than normal. We have several things going on. We've got the foreclosure report, which are the properties that are in the process of foreclosure for non-payment of taxes, and some of them are pulled from auction for various reasons, usually environmental. We put easements on them, that kind of thing. So that'll be brought up. That first report about that will be tomorrow. There's two assessment items, possible exemptions that we're looking at concerning housing. So you'll hear more about those. As a resolution about the performance measurement system for the county, and then a resolution about public Wi-Fi internet access. That's all on tomorrow's agenda.
Questions for Dan? And we have this resolution you just added.
Yes, I would like to move it, authorizing the county administrator to establish a shared services panel and to undertake the tasks assigned to county chief executive officers by state shared services legislation.
Seconded by Glenn. Discussion. Can I just say that I was the one that suggested that we have this resolution, and the reason for that is because this state legislation is very unusual in that it directs the county executives and administrators and managers to do the work of putting the shared services panel together. As you know, our county administrator is employed by this legislature and takes direction from us. And so I thought it was pretty important that we have an authorizing resolution which indicates that he has our support to go through with what the state is asking our county to do. Other comments? Rich.
I would echo what you just said, Mike, and I'm troubled by the state law in that it really gives the legislators a free pass from responsibility.
And state legislators.
The state giving us.
The county legislators.
The county legislators. We should be blamed for this if it's not a good plan. And now we can skate on that. And that's just not the way the state should have set this up. With that said, I will vote for it.
Peter?
Excuse me, I'm mixed up. Suppose we defeat this resolution, then what happens?
I think he still has to follow state law, but then he's betwixt and between, because which master does he serve?
Exactly. I mean, what is that a problem?
Yeah, it's a problem.
Joe, I'm just wondering, what would your answer be to that question?
I'd still have to follow the law.
So,
I'd still have to follow the state law.
Okay, thank you.
Martha.
I think we have to, my sense of this is the fact that there are no sanctions, no financial sanctions, is a really big deal. And it's clear from the politics of this that we weren't going to get away with nothing like this. The governor needed to be sure to, every year he's got to find something to hit us with. And he's running out of ideas. So this, you know, his plan with the financial sanctions and putting it on the ballot and all this other stuff that he came out with his program budget was much worse than what we're looking at now. So I think this is the legislature, frankly, negotiating a favor for us. And maybe I'm naive, but this is the way I see it, is that otherwise we'd be looking at something we'd really be stuck with. Now, what happens if we don't, I don't know, do whatever it's like? I don't know. So what? But that's the so what part. On the other hand, there's opportunity here. So the tight timeline is ridiculous.
And I think we just do the best we can do. But, you know, I know how long it takes to get the people on this list together for a meeting. Like, I don't think you can have three of those between now and August. It's not going to happen. So so I think this let's do the best we can on this. Let's do a responsible job. Let's see it as an opportunity, especially if we can get school districts engaged, because I think there's a lot we should talk about with them, and we never do. So, you know, I don't feel so bad about this. I think we should make lemonade out of it.
Carol?
So, yeah, no, I'm in support of doing this. I just, if we're going to do it, I have some questions about how we should do it. First of all, in the first sentence, the first whereas, so I have some suggestions, or at least questions, about whether we ought to make some minor adjustments. The first whereas, if the initiative says requires counties to assume the lead role, is that not quite accurate?
That's
part BBB of chapter 59 of the laws of 2017. Should we be saying require? I mean, essentially, if asking county administrators is asking, or executives is asking counties.
Well,
it's assuming you're our representative.
Right. Counties are the hub in this hub and spoke thing. We're right in the middle of it, and the expectations are placed on counties to develop these plans and report them out.
Okay, so that's accurate. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, now, do we want to... Are you required to have legislators on this panel?
No, the panel is set by law. It's mayors and supervisors. They have to be on. And school superintendents, you can actually have a representative of a special benefit district also on it. They may be on it. So it is set in the law who is on the panel.
Does it exclude legislators?
It is specific on who is on the panel, right?
Okay, so I would recommend that we make sure to have some legislative representatives on this panel.
But that's, now again, the law says the panel will consist of mayors and supervisors.
Okay.
And also we can invite school superintendents and special benefit district folks.
So in some counties, you've got your executive is elected. Right. So you then, in those counties, you have somebody accountable to the electorate, to the public, who who has to be on the panel. Does the governor not understand that some counties the executive or administrator is not elected, and some they are? Because he doesn't seem to.
But I think you're making the argument,
we do,
Carol, for why we should
we
do
should
this.
We should make sure to have somebody. Well, I'm also suggesting that we make sure to have somebody, we direct our administrator to have one of us, our chair at least, on this panel.
I think attend the meeting would
right.
probably be fine.
But municipal people are elected, as our Board of Education. So everybody on that board is elected. It's just not county.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to spend some money of the recommendations they come up with.
Okay.
So I do think that we ought to...
Any other questions?
Wait,
Carol?
No, I'm not done. So I would, if there's any sympathy for this, I would require that we have somebody there. And I was going to ask whether we somehow ought to be helping to take responsibility for the time frame so that... We recognize that they may not be able to do this work, and that because we're going to have to spend the dollars, we want reports as he goes along, and we want, maybe those are two questions. Do we want reports as this goes along? I know Joe gives us reports, but do we want to require them?
Well, Carol, at
and
this
the,
point...
The other question is, do we want to take some responsibility for the time frame and direct him that if they don't think they can accomplish
it. I guess the question is, if you want that, you ought to move an amendment and see whether it has any support.
Well, maybe other people can raise their hands if they agree with me. I would move it if there was... you know, another call for it here. I'm not going to waste your time if there isn't. But I think we're leaving Joe kind of out there hanging, and I think we're leaving the taxpayers of Tompkins County out there hanging a little bit if we're subject to the, you know, if we're going to have to react to the recommendations of this panel and pay for them. A lot of this stuff is going to come out of the county budget.
Are we ready to vote? Dooley?
I had a couple of questions. There are no line numbers, so it's the last whereas. There's wording that says in the middle, soliciting input of all collective bargaining of panel members. There must be some word there that's missing. Is it collective bargaining units?
That's a good idea. It should be collective bargaining units.
Okay.
Yes.
The other question I had was, what does presenting a tentative plan to the county legislature for its review, what does the review consist of? Is that spelled out?
No, but the legislature, the law talks about what the legislature can do. So it can modify the plan, and if there's a modification, I then need to report back to the state to reestimate the savings associated with the modified plan. Or it can write, and it could be and or, write an advisory report to the panel. So if the legislature has strong reservations, different thoughts, whatever, those would be conveyed to the panel after you've had a chance to review the plan.
Okay. I wish that were spelled out a little more clearly here.
All right, are we ready to vote?
Yes.
All those in favor, please raise your hand. Are there any opposed? That's unanimous. Dan, anything else?
No, thank you.
Let's go to Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee. Martha Robertson is chair. She's missing. Let's skip over to Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis is chair.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mike. First thing, we have a meeting Monday, May 8th at 4 p.m. right here. And in your red folders, and I believe everyone got the September-October EBC schedule. We've added one meeting, one more than we normally have. And, you know, given a couple of things that we learned after last year's process. And so there are 10 meetings devoted to the budget, 3 voting meetings, and 7 meetings of department heads and things like that. The budget committee will deal with the fiscal target and goal at the May 8th meeting. The following month, we will deal with the piece of legislation that we pass every year early on to go over the cap if we have to, giving us the permission to do that. So other than that, the other thing is we were going to have a discussion of tourism, STPB, and ACOD. Tom Knipe is out of the auditorium on Monday, and I expect that he should be there, so we've moved that to June. Other than that, I have no questions.
Questions?
No more comments.
Carol.
Just a note in public. At September 20th, you have on here, that is the evening of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish holiday.
You know, it's for your – take a look at it. We have put this out before. This is not the first time this has been around. And it had been presented to all of you, and we were hoping people would give input at that point.
So, Jim, I can't be at the Budget Committee, but if you look on a calendar, a public calendar, Rosh Hashanah is listed as the 21st, but it's observed from sundown the night before till sundown that night. So it looks to me like you did try to avoid the holiday. And
I will take that into consideration.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Leslie.
Jim, you said this came out before now?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the first draft.
Okay. I thought you were saying that we had a draft before this.
No, I think we...
Oh, I got it now. I
think we circulated something that looked like a draft, and no, we didn't. What did we circulate that we were looking for?
I don't think that went to the
that was for the budget
retreat.
I don't
think that went to the full legislature.
Sorry.
Gee.
Well, all the better, because now people can comment on the draft.
I've talked about this so much with Kevin that I thought it went out. I apologize.
I got it.
Thanks for your comments. We will take it into consideration and probably make some changes.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Let's go to Jail Study Committee. Rich John?
Do you want to go back to planning first? Or?
No.
We missed planning.
Yeah.
You've been gone. Do you want to go back to planning?
All right. Let's skip it.
All right. Let's do Planning, Development, Environmental Quality Committee. Martha Robertson's back.
Thank you. Sorry I stepped out at the wrong time. We will meet on Thursday, this Thursday at 3 o'clock in this room, and we have there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff. We are going to see the first draft of the housing strategy, which has been discussed at the Planning Advisory Board and some other groups, but this is going to come directly to the Planning Committee on Thursday. We're also going to be looking at a sustainability update of county operations. I just realized, Mike, you said you're not going to be here or only for part of it, and Dooley, you're not going to be here?
When?
This Thursday?
No, I expect to be.
You will be. Okay. All right. Okay, so we will have a quorum then. Okay. You're going to race Joe back from that other meeting. Right. I understand. There's been a lot going on with sustainability, with energy, and we're going to get a report of the energy focus areas study, which that report is finished now, about the four areas in the county that were studied together with NYSEG. So there's a lot of meaty stuff to talk about, and I'm sure we'll talk about Mike because he won't be there. So.
Very good.
That's it.
Questions? Thank you, Martha. Now we'll go to Rich, Jail Study.
Thank you, Mike. Jail Study Committee met, I can't remember the date, but it's April meeting. We heard reports from several providers of services at the jail, AA, for males and females. A group that does therapy sessions, and OAR came as well. It was a really good discussion about what goes on with the people in the jail. Our next meeting, as I indicated earlier, is the 11th, so it's a week from this Thursday rather than the 18th. And I anticipate we're going to have the nurse from the jail come in and talk about the medical facilities, and a county employee, and I'm blanking on the name.
Sharon McDougall.
Thank you. Sharon McDougall is going to talk about mental health services.
Questions? Jim?
I have moved the IDA meeting to 2 o'clock on that day, but the reason I moved it was because there is a get-together at TC3, isn't it, honoring Carl, that starts at?
On the 11th?
Starts at 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. So if you're on jail study, we're blowing that off? I mean, is that?
I thought that we had set it up that you could go to the beginning of it, and that's what I was going to try to do, and then step out to go to the jail study.
The following week is the county's 25-year dinner.
No,
so that,
I understand that. But,
right.
And Carl's thing starts at 5, is that it?
Oh, I thought it was
four.
Early.
I think it's 4.
Starts at 4, 4 to 7.
4, but the formal program begins at 5.
Yeah, we were boxed in.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Martha. Or thank you, Jim. Whoever's turn it was. Thank you, Rich.
Okay.
Let's go to Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. It's Leslie McBean Claiborne, who's the chair.
Oh, dear. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start my report off with person out of the room as Martha was trying to respond some to Peter's question. And I want to thank the people in the community who came together and put on a community read of the new Jim Crow book and had a series of monthly discussions on each of the chapters of the book that spoke to the issue of mass incarceration and its impact and effect on black and brown folks in our country. I remember very distinctly sort of a portion in chapter 3 of that book that speaks about drug and drug use and the issues of that thing. So we have a problem with a thing that is drugs, but the punishment is on people, not the thing. We attack the people, not the thing. And just in being involved in some of these discussions last night was the last one about where do we go from here after we've read this book and heard so much and been so involved in a lot of emotional testimony from people who have had their experiences of being in jails and prison and understanding how systems are designed to be blatantly, some covertly, discriminatory, and how racism plays such a key role in keeping black and brown people in jails and prisons at disproportionate numbers. So if you have not read The New Jim Crow, and there's been many books and studies prior to this, I do encourage reading and conversation. I'm happy to engage in conversation with anyone around it. Discrimination, prejudice, bigotry, and injustice in what's supposed to be a just system. Are much of what are responsible for the disproportionate number of black people and brown people who are in our jails and prisons. And you just have to watch the news sometimes and see more and more with modern-day DNA testing. How many people are being exonerated after they've lost so much of their lives, being locked up? How many people take those plea bargains, particularly poor black and brown folks who are afraid that they're going to lose their children, not be there, but take plea bargains, plea to things that they're not guilty of. I'm not saying people don't do stuff and they're not guilty and, you know, before a jury of your peers and all those things happen. I'm not saying that by any means. But the naked truth is those ugly social ills play a very significant role in keeping African Americans, Latino Americans, locked up, thrown in jails and prisons, and locked up. Now that I've gotten that off of my chest, not fully, I still have a whole lot more to say, but it's late. Again, I want to thank the folks who pulled that community read together and for everyone who attended and made commitments to help effect change in our society. And I hope that they will live up to those commitments. Because until such time as some of these issues start hitting home to some of us, we're never going to understand them. And it's never going to be priority for change. Heroin addiction, drug addiction has been an issue in the black and brown community. And we were locking people up for it. But as soon as it started to hit in bigger numbers, the white community, our government, our society, is now beginning to look at what are ways that we can treat this. So let's be real about what has been happening in this society and others. I just want to put it out there. Workforce, and that's all part of diversity and inclusion. We had our meeting. We had some conversations about exit interviews because WDIC had put as homework assignment for our HR department, we'd asked them to really look into what it would mean for us to engage as a county in exit interviews. Because when our county administrator presented to us our diversity metrics, his concern, rightfully placed, is that we seem to be going a little backwards in terms of retaining different classes of people within our county government. And we want to know why. What's going on? We should be so much further ahead. So we ask, if people are leaving, how do we find out from them why they're leaving? If we know it's not because we've terminated their employment and people are resigned, they're going, how do we find out why? And so we have this conversation that's going to continue around exit interviews. There was concern about what do we do with the information when we get it? Do we open ourselves up for, you know, liabilities and lawsuits and complaints, because people will now say this is the reason why I left county employment and it might be something that borders on discrimination. Who knows? I'm just saying that. It was part of the conversation. Then what do we do with that information? Are we preparing ourselves to deal with it, or are we just going to avoid the whole exit interview thing, which from a workforce diversity and inclusion perspective, we should not be doing. So that conversation will continue at WDIC. Our HR department intends to bring back, you know, sort of a draft that we can tear apart and then bring to this body at some point soon, I hope. Information, one to share, and perhaps to take action on whether this county should make that one of our policies and procedures, that we should engage in meaningful exit interviews. And what do we do about those? So that's part of the conversation that will continue. The Workforce Diversity Inclusion Committee was also responsible for the safe zone cards that you see around. We ask that departments have them and so on. And we felt very strongly that we don't just put something up and don't educate people about what we do. So the county administrator, in his wisdom, and I, we talked about it and said we should have a informative educational video about what it means to be a safe zone. What are the expectations? What is your responsibility when you display that card? What is your responsibility as a member of county government? And I don't just mean this body. I meant our entire county government. And a county administrator asked our Office of Human Rights to create a video that our employees can engage in listening to, viewing, and being educated around what it means. our Human Rights Department rose to the challenge, and they presented to us. We asked them to present to WDIC the draft video so that we can see it. It was very well done. All the staff in the Human Rights Department took part in explaining what this means, as well as just what it means to create a safe environment for all workers, customers, clients, people we interact with. It's an 8-minute video, and I'm asking, because I still consider it in draft form, because we would really love for the members of the LGBT community to also have a chance to take a look at it and tell us, you know, does this do for you what it should do? Does it really capture what is intended by that card? So we intend to have our Health and Human Services Committee take a look at it, our Budget Committee take a look at it, and we also intend to have it here at your next legislature meeting for all of you and the viewing public to take a look at it, because we'd love as much input as possible so that we have a tool that works and works well. So that was the other thing we did, a major thing we did at WDIC as well. Like I said, it was well put together, and there were suggestions for making sure that it's accessible with closed captioning. So there's work that still needs to be done, and again, it's in draft form. So I just wanted to share those things with you. That was sort of the bulk of our committee discussion. And we are gearing up for our climate survey. So pretty soon we'll be working on the guidance of Paula Younger, Deputy County Administrator Paula Younger, and our County Administrator will soon be looking to put together a team of people to help move the 2018 climate survey forward. So people for marketing, people for reviewing questions. So we'll be calling all of you to participate as well. We don't want people to just sit on the sidelines and point fingers when it's all done. But if you have input, we really would like your input. So stay tuned. You'll hear more about that. That's my report. And I'm sorry it took so long, but I had to get some stuff off my chest.
I guess we've gone by the three-minute limit a lot of times here tonight. Questions for Leslin. Anna.
Just a quick addition, that if anybody hasn't read the new Jim Crow, but wants to, I have 3 or 4 copies of it in my car downstairs. So please ask me, and I will share it with you. Also, if you don't have the time to fit it into your schedule right now, but you really want to understand these issues, Peter, you brought up a couple things and said, you know, I don't know, which I appreciate acknowledging sometimes that we don't know. That documentary will answer a lot of your questions. 13th is the name of the documentary. 2 hours of your time. Please, 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 I beseech every one of you to watch it.
Carol?
Yes. Yeah, I was sort of going the same place as Anna, but I think that there, if you don't catch Anna coming out into her car tonight, I did read that there are copies of CD available for the community. I don't know if they were the ones that were in the library or that had been on loan to people who participated. So if you are interested, and Peter, I do. I was going to also point out that this book, it's a not an easy read, but it and I didn't make it through all of it, but it you know would give an interesting perspective on some of the questions that you raised. Either read it and or you can also get to, I think, there were small group discussions, but 2 of the big community presentations are on the, I think it's on the Multicultural Resource Center's website. If you just search for the new Jim Crow, Ithaca, you'll get to, 2 of them are online. And then on the video, Leslin, where
if we want to watch it or in advance or send it to some people, like making clear it's a draft, who wouldn't be able to come, but we, from whom we might want to solicit input, is there somewhere we could watch it?
I know they were going to have it somewhere, but I don't think it's up just yet. Right, Joe?
This is the Safe
Zones video.
It's not up yet. They're doing the closed captioning right now, so it's a work in progress. We do expect to have it ready, the next draft for this meeting.
But still in a draft form. But if we want to get comments from people who maybe aren't going to be able to come and watch it here with us, but this is where we're going to be giving input.
Office of Human
You can probably
Rights?
Do an attachment and just send that by email.
Can
I'll check
it
if you want.
When you have it,
we can
a
do
link
that.
To something. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Wilson. The old library, if I got someone else, Dooley.
Well, I don't know whether Lesson can shed any light on this or not, but in one of my rare forays looking at my email, there was a survey from some intern, and it seemed to ask a bunch of diversity questions, but it was quite incomplete as to the variety of diversities that were being asked about. Can you shed any light on that?
No, ma'am. I cannot.
Okay, thank you.
Is that the... I don't know. I remember seeing something to do. Yeah, I cannot. It's not anything that had to do with the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. I have no idea where it came from. But I'm glad you did that, because I have to say one other quick thing, Mike. Just reading in the news about New York State, we banned the box here, banned the box in the city, and reading in the news about trying to ban sort of that information about last income from applications, because that's also being used to rule out candidates for jobs. And so the state is sort of, someone is introducing legislation, remember who it is, to take action against that. So we'll probably be looking at something like that soon as well. I'm done now. I really am.
Mike?
Yeah.
I forgot to tell Leslie. The survey had to do with diversity on advisory committees.
Leslie, you said you were done.
I forgot to mention.
You want to take a stab at that joke?
Well, the initiative is from Human Rights.
Yes.
So it didn't come from WDIC. This is something that they have initiated.
Martha?
Yeah, and I had a question about, I'm on, 15 boards or something as a liaison, and I don't think we're in the same category as community members who put on those. So I haven't had a chance to go back to HR, Human Rights, and find out, but I haven't filled it out, so 15 times. I think that salary issue also has to do with continual wage discrimination. When somebody says, well, I made $50,000 at my last job, so great, I don't have to pay her more than $50,000 or $55,000. So, thanks.
All right, can I move on?
Yes.
Old Library Committee has not met.
Cool.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John.
Thank you, Mike. I'll start out. I have a resolution for consideration by the legislature. It's resolution number A, appropriation from contingent fund replacement pay sheriff's office. And I would move it.
Seconded by Martha. Short form roll call.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous.
Thank you. The Public Safety Committee met on April 20th, and we had a report on the proposed LEAD program that is moving forward mainly in the city, but there's county involvement. And that looks like it is going to go into operation. We're not quite sure when, but I think it's a good development. The Public Safety Committee is scheduled to meet again on May 18th at 3:30.
Questions? Thank you, Rich. Health and Human Services Committee, Anna Kellis is chair.
We have not met since the last legislative meeting. I'm putting together the agenda now. Hopefully we'll get some information on that survey for you duly at the next meeting. And that meeting is May 15th at 4:30 p.m. at our normally scheduled time.
Questions? Thank you, Anna. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Dave McKenna is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. F&I has not met since the last legislature meeting. We will be meeting in these chambers May 9th at 3 p.m.
Questions, Jim?
No, not a question.
Any other questions? Thank you, Dave. Let's take the minutes of previous meeting, April 18th. Moved by Jim. Is there a second? Seconded by Mike. Any discussion? Dooley?
Well, packet page 12, page 2, third paragraph, Dr. Klepak's name is misspelled.
Let's see if we can fix that. Ready to vote? All those in favor? Any opposed? We have one opposed. Is there any unfinished business tonight? Jim?
Yes. I just wanted to give a short report from the IDA, and we have a couple of big solar issues coming up. Town of Dryden is trying to do a couple of commercial solar fields, and we're waiting on what the town of Dryden is going to do about that. We have a couple of solar operations that want to get set up in the town of Enfield, and we will be trying to offer a pilot for those two projects.
Questions?
That's all I have.
Thanks for that report. Anything else on unfinished business? I'll take a motion to adjourn. Mike Sigler, seconded by Dan Klein. All in favor? Opposed? Carried. Thank you to Kathy Covert, Michelle Pothorpe, to Marsha Lynch, and to Jim Blizzard.